Hola, mi
Hey,
¿qué pasa?
De nada. What? I think I switched languages.
Supposed to say bien.
Bien, yeah, bien.
All right, well, we're going to get started with John. So I'm going to dial him in here.
John M. Wilson is our guest today on Geek Brunch Retrocast. I think it's episode
Do I sound
67?
okay?
Seven.
Sound quality wise?
Yeah.
Because I did a sound test and it sounded very muted. Does it sound okay? Volume?
Yeah, it sounds pretty normal.
Okay.
I think.
You think? We're dialing.
I'm answering.
Yes. Welcome.
Hello,
hello.
Hello,
Superman.
I'm Mike, just so you know the voice, and Chris is Chris. Where are you, Chris?
I'm somewhere over here.
He's on the right-hand side of my screen.
So. Yeah, there you are. He's the cat.
Okay. Actually, I don't have a picture for Chris. I have a picture for Mike, frightening though it may be.
Yeah, the crossed.
But Chris is just a generic blue.
That's okay. Pretty much sums me up. I'm just a generic blue.
He's just a smurf.
Actually, that's weird because he comes across as a cat to me.
Maybe I have to accept his personals in order to
oh,
get
that's
his cat.
That's probably true.
There's a treating a girl right before you get the pussy joke in there somewhere. But I'm not going to make it because I'm a gentleman.
That's right. So, welcome to the Retrocast. We've been recently bringing other comics fans into the mix on the show, and we pretty much cover whatever we feel like going back 10 years or older. So everything then is ball game, even though I think I cheated once.
You can't cheat. You make your own rules. You got to stand by them.
Nah.
We don't talk about that. We don't talk about that time.
Yeah. We forgot about it until I mentioned it again. I forgot what year I was in. That's the problem.
Yeah. It's all that time traveling.
I went, yeah, the Time Master. I was like Rip Hunter there for just a little bit.
Does that mean you used to play Rory on another show?
Yeah. Okay, so, well, we usually start this off by asking a couple questions, and then we get into what we're covering for the week, which is just a miscellaneous books or whatever. And so we usually kick it off with a series of questions, but the first one we start usually with is like, what got you into comics? I know you on Facebook as a hardcore Superman fan, so I'd like to know.
I wasn't always, though. It's kind of weird. Superman fandom is kind of a relatively new thing for me. How did I get into comics? Way back in the day. No, I was young and had chicken pox, and my dad got me these three collected Spider-Man paperbacks that were published in the late 70s, although it was mid 80s when I got them. And between the three of them, they collected the first 20 Spider-Man issues.
Oh, were they the small paperbacks?
Like the little pocketbook
size
paperbacks.
Yeah, I used to get those at like the B. Dalton bookstore.
Yeah, they did it for several different characters. I know they did Fantastic Four, but they did three Spider-Man ones. And that was the definition of comics for me for a while. Like, learning the terminology, like the idea that they were monthly and everything. It was all kind of this mysterious thing because I wasn't actually getting comics. And then the first comic I bought off the shelf whenever I was older and had some money, and my dad said, hey, there is such a thing as a comic book store. And I was like, really? Let's go find this creature. And I bought Amazing Spider-Man 341, which is cover dated November 1990. I bought that off the shelf. I was 11 years old. And that was the beginning of Spider-Man had just lost his powers in the previous issue. So it was the beginning of a three-part story where he's trying to be Spider-Man with none of his spider powers. It was really weird because I had grown up on Ditko Spider-Man, and suddenly he's married to this hot redhead. He and
Yeah.
Flash are friends. What the hell's up with that?
The art style changed dramatically too.
Yeah, and I mean, that's Eric Larson, and after just a few issues more, it switched over to Mark Bagley, who, has ostensibly a similar style. At first glance, they look pretty similar.
Yeah, he went from McFarlane to Larson to Bagley.
Yeah, they kind of had a lot of similarities. I prefer Bagley nowadays over Larson, although I do still really dig me some 90s Savage Dragon Eric Larson stuff. So, read comics for a while, mostly Marvel, got a few other stuff, was really into the Marvel 2099 stuff when it started. Didn't really read much DC. In fact, the only DC that I bought and read were the Armageddon 2001 annuals and the Death of Superman trade paperback.
Oh, nice.
So that was weird because Luthor had hair and Supergirl was a purple ooze monster creature, and it was kind of bizarre. But then I kind of got out of buying comics around the time that Maximum Carnage hit. That just I was kind of bored by then, and I bought a few other things, a few more issues of some other things, but Maximum Carnage stands out in my mind as the okay, I think I'm basically done with this, because Spider-Man was sort of my driving character, and if I wasn't collecting Spider-Man, then well, why continue living?
Do you still read Spider-Man?
The current stuff I don't. I've read a lot of stuff since One More Day, Brand New Day, and a lot of the Dan Slott run. I read Superior, really, really liked Superior. And then about the time that Peter Parker came back, I was distracted by other reading projects. So right now, I have a couple of years of Spider-Man to catch up on.
Nice.
But I came back into it because of two things. The Star Wars comics did a sort of publishing initiative relaunch sort of thing with four series called Legacy, Knights of the Old Republic, Dark Times, and I want to say Republic, but it might have been Empire. Anyways, so I started buying those, and that got me back into comic shops. And then whenever Iron Man hit, I realized I wanted to read superheroes again. And by that point, a lot of like huge collections of old comics were being put out on DVD by Get Corp. So I got like, 50 years of Iron Man, 50 years of Fantastic Four, and read a lot of those. And then I continue to read just about everything that I can think of to read because of the internet and its amazing things.
Yeah. So
But
Chris,
definitely some.
Chris started Marvel too.
Yeah,
You're
I
the
was gonna say
third
definitely
person I've talked to that's done that.
some similar similarities in our reading histories there, because that's kind of how I started, was with Marvel, kind of in the same period time, maybe just a little bit earlier, but also very focused on Spider-Man. I came in right around the start of Eric Larson's run, and when Bagley took over, that was around the time when I stopped reading comics for a while, but also came back in later, more connected to the X-Men movies coming out, because that was my other big thing besides Spider-Man. And then just kind of have been in and out of comics since, but wasn't at all a DC Comics collector, reader growing up, and it wasn't until as an adult that I got pretty hardcore into DC. So yeah,
Yeah,
definitely
my
some
DC
things I can
stuff came pretty
identify
late
there.
too.
Yeah,
It
but
was probably 2009-ish, and I was like, I think I'll try some DC and ask some friends, who do you like? Who should I try? And I'd read a lot of Batman as a kid because my brother collected it, so I thought I'd try some Superman, and started reading from the beginning of the post-crisis stuff because that's pretty available in trades, and then around that time. I discovered the early days of a podcast called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, where they're basically kind of indexing their way through all of the Superman stories between Crisis on Infinite Earths and Infinite Crisis.
Right.
So I was just getting into it, and then they were there to talk about it with me. So it's like I had, people to listen to and ja get jazzed about it. And since then, I've been reading lots and lots and lots and lots of Superman.
Yeah, now you, just so listeners know, I think the first place I heard you was on Amazing Spider-Man Classics. Is that the right
Yes.
title? Yeah. So I had heard a number of more episodes of that show because I was kind of a similar thing. I was going back and rereading. First time I read a bunch of Amazing Spider-Man, a bunch of the old stuff. Like I hadn't been exposed to the Ditko stuff prior to reading it as a kid, but once there was kind of a period of time where I wasn't into comics heavy, and it was before I actually got back into reading single issues that I sought out the essentials, and that was really my first time, kind of like maybe in college, my first time reading the original Spider-Man and X-Men stuff in the essential volumes. But then once since the Ditko stuff, that early stuff is so rereadable, eventually I was rereading it again with Marvel Unlimited and was listening to Amazing Spider-Man Classics along with that for a while. But you've also done a Superman podcast, I believe, and then currently you're still doing, I believe, the Avengers Inspirations, if I get the title right. And that's with your daughter, I believe.
Yeah, my daughter, who is 13, she just turned 14. She and I a couple years ago started talking about a lot of the old Marvel Silver Age comics that featured characters from the Avengers franchise of films, which then became TV and film, and then became more than just Avengers. And at one point, building up to the second Avengers film, we started rewatching and talking about our rewatch as we went along. So it has now become kind of much more of a Marvel Cinematic Universe with also Silver Age comics mixed in podcast. Episodes are kind of intermittent. She's a middle schooler, and getting together to record can be kind of touch and go. So, but yeah, we do that show, and that's lots of fun. Other projects I've been involved in, they've kind of come and gone. My muses tends to be fickle, but I have recently started a giant Superman podcast with a friend of mine, Bob Fisher, where we look at old school Superman stories from the Silver Age as they were collected in the annuals, the giant sized annuals that DC put out. So the giant Superman annuals, each episode will go through about half an annual because they're big, and we talk a lot. So we do Superman there, and I do Avengers with my daughter, and I keep thinking about that Spider-Man classic show because Spider-Man was my first love or whatever. So I keep thinking about ways I might revive that, and that might be happening this year, but
That's
it's probably
cool.
too early to say anything.
Yeah, I just figured we'd mention some of that stuff up front because a lot of the projects that you do sort of fit into the, well, not just sort of, but they're all kind of retro, at least by the definition that we work by here. And yeah, the Avengers, I've heard a few episodes of the Avengers Inspirations show, and that is a neat concept, especially kind of to kind of hear your daughter's perspective of these Silver Age comics, and the perspective that she had comes from being, just a teenager and stuff, reading them, coming from the direction of, even though those are older comics than even what we started with, it's interesting to hear someone that's seeing these huge movies in the theaters that we all thought would never even exist. And they can kind of accept them as fact and then go back and look at, wow, these characters have been around for decades,
And they've changed a lot over the years.
Oh yeah. Definitely.
They change, but always come back and be the same.
Sometimes, but
It's very cyclical. So people bitch and complain, and things get back to the way they were.
it's interesting because I feel like returning to a status quo is becoming less of a priority in comics these days. And maybe that's just, maybe the cycle has simply gotten fatter and it's going to take a longer while to get back there. But give Captain America, for example. I don't ever know. I don't know if his character as like a personal life and everything ever really had a status quo, but it seems like the only thing that's normal about him is Steve Rogers being in the suit. So
Well, no,
if we can.
they had a lot during the year when God, it was in the 80s when he was dating Bernie and
And that's, yeah,
had
I
the
was reading
Serpent
Bernie in
Society.
the early 90s, right? The Serpent Society was one of the first
Yeah.
stories I read. So
Yeah,
they had
so
stuff,
he
but
had
now
his
it's.
personal life. Now he's always he's always in working.
Right.
Yeah,
We
and
never see Steve.
he has some had some stuff with Carter, but it's been brief, and now he's old and but he's coming back. So
Yeah,
like
they're
you
going to
said,
rejuvenate him in time for the second movie because that's how things work now.
that's the way they work.
Yeah, you knew
So
that was going to happen. Yeah.
it was
And
just a matter of time.
it's not something I'm cynical about, but it's one of those things where, okay, if they're going to do a big change to a character and that character is a movie franchise, you can probably put down $10 saying that it's going to be back to something like normal when the movie comes out.
Or not.
Yeah. It tends to be
It
so
tends to be
far, at least what Marvel's been doing.
Bruce Wayne's gonna be back as Batman and Superman's gonna be back to full power in time for March. And that's not a coincidence. That's just the way things work now.
Yeah, Batman's back.
And you're gonna get in trouble.
Yeah. I like the change though, 'cause it's to me it's like it's fascinating to see what works and what doesn't so much work. And some stuff, even though that some fans don't like it, I think it works. So it's just a matter of opinion. And like I know that a lot of people got into DC Comics because of the New 52, and they enjoy the New 52. And now they're going to get a rebirth, and they're going through things that the other group went through. But I've been through like many generations of this, so it doesn't faze me one bit. I just like roll with the punch and just, what's next?
Yeah, I'm hoping that Rebirth is more of just a big initiative and a change in focus and not a huge continuity shift.
did
I think
you
these.
did you watch the Geoff Johns video?
Someone has posted it while I was talking to you just now. I saw it and I was like, "Oh, I should watch that 'cause, but I can't stop podcasting to watch it." So
It's hard to tell what it's going to be based on what it is, but its focus is on like what Geoff Johns did with Hal Jordan and what he did with Flash and JSA and Legion, and it sounds like he's getting back to the basics of what he thinks these characters should be or who the writers that are creators that are working on them should be. So
Well,
it
the Green Lantern Rebirth and the JSA JLA revival stuff or that he was involved with, those are taking established characters and established continuities and just changing your tone and story focus. And I'm cool with that. I'm down with that. I just don't. I think the more often the DC changes the rules, like Superman kept getting nudged in different directions all through the early 2000s. And then 2006 is Infinite Crisis, and then the origin is unclear. It seems like they're not really sure what it's going to be. And then Final Crisis comes down and changes things. Well, not really for Superman very much, but then Secret Origin comes down, and just enough time sitting with Secret Origin saying this is the origin. Whenever Flashpoint comes down and changes the rules again, so I'd really like them to stick with the continuity and maybe just shift focus and the stories they're telling. If that makes sense.
And that may be. You can't really tell yet, based on what they've released. I think either way it'll work, for me anyway. I'm not concerned. I think it'll be, 'cause I'm enjoying the books now. So
Yeah, I'm thinking about the Truth hardcovers start hitting next month, or this month. I'm not sure when this is going out, but in March they're going to start dropping hardcovers collecting the Truth storylines, and I'm thinking about putting more episodes on my new 52 Adventures of Superman show that I haven't done in a while, and just talking about the new stuff because I'm enjoying it too. I like the idea of addressing questions that don't normally get addressed. What would Superman act like if he had lost his powers and people were out to get him because they felt betrayed and he was untrustworthy. And one thing I've learned about reading Silver Age Superman is Superman is a great guy whenever he's okay. But if he loses his powers or something else goes along that really messes up his emotional, you know, equilibrium, Superman can get really angry and really jerky really fast.
And drink beer and throw peanuts at the mirror.
There's that too, you know, it happens. So I think he's actually handled himself with aplomb during all of this truth scenario. You know,
Well, I think they went in a direction, it's just a weird direction, because they did it to two of their big two at the exact same time. They basically say, okay, Superman's this and Batman is this. And I think it was a dramatic shift. And it sounds like, you know, at least I'm caught up on Batman. I'm not caught up on Superman. That we're shifting definitely back.
Yeah, right now is the middle of the Savage Dawn storyline, which is both a culmination of all the different parallel stories going on in the truth and a setup to get him back into full power by issue 50.
Right.
So it's doing both of those things. And Wonder Woman, you know, got a costume change and a new creative team, but not really much in the way of huge shifts in her situation.
Not in her situation, but in Donna Troy's, it was pretty.
They did bring about the new Donna Troy now, and and I dug it. And I heard a lot of bitching and complaining.
Yeah, it was different. I didn't think it was bad, but going back to some of our questions, we would like to figure out too. Back in, you know, music is a very influential thing, especially during your middle school years and your high school years. What kind of music choices did you listen to back in that time period?
Oh, I am a disappointing, boring soul in that circumstance, because I was pretty religious as a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
So like DC Talk and Jars of Clay, they were kind of my thing. But by the end of high school, I was more with the Cranberries and Smashing Pumpkins. All of the, what were they, at the time they called it alternative rock.
Yeah, you were graduating high school when I was done with college.
Yeah, it was 97 that I walked. So I think we're the same age then. Yeah.
You're going to be, I'll be 37 this year.
Yeah, 37 this year.
Oh, okay. Yay. Normally everyone's always older than me on this show, so.
Okay, what month are you?
April.
I'm not even older than you. I'm June.
Oh, wow.
So you don't have to be the baby this time.
All right. I can get my gray hairs ready.
Right?
Your cane.
Yep.
So I was dating a girl the summer after high school, and she lived about an hour drive away, and she worked at a Walmart and got off at 11. So I did a lot of, you know, late night driving to go see her. And that was really as much as I got into music, was just during that time, because I never really did collect music a whole lot, but
not even your parents would listen to music that influenced your choices.
I remember our first CD that we got was Amy Grant, Heart in Motion.
Ah. So
that's a thing that happened. We had the cassette for the Ninja Turtles Coming Out of Their Shells tour.
Oh, wow.
Whenever we were young, my sister was a big Madonna and Cyndi Lauper fan in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
We were on the swing set singing Like a Virgin. So, and I watched a lot of MTV and a lot of VH1, but as far as like really getting into a particular thing, I never
You go from Amy Grant to Madonna, who's the extreme opposite.
My family was a diverse culture.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. I mean, Amy Grant was kind of the first real crossover. A lot of people know Amy Grant. Not everybody knows that her, like, she came out of that like contemporary Christian music background, and she really had that crossover. Like, I didn't have that background growing up, but towards the end of high school, I became friends with a lot of kids that were Christian and into like Christian alternative music and stuff like that. And so I kind of got exposed to that background from them and their families. And, like I remembered Amy Grant, Heart in Motion, like just seeing that video on MTV. It was a real popular song and stuff. But then to find out, that she had that Christian contemporary music background, and that like a lot of people when that song came out in that community thought, oh, she's like, crossing over, she's, betraying the community and all this stuff. So that was kind of interesting to
Well,
find out about.
Jars of Clay kind of hit it big in the alternative scene too. I mean,
Yep, yeah. A
I remember when they hit
little
it.
later on.
I didn't even know they were religious. And
Yeah, because they actually
from
did
that
get some
movement.
mainstream play.
But I guess their album was titled Flood, so if you like pay more attention to their lyrics
Nowadays,
that
if
are
I'm on
rocking
a
out.
long drive and I want to put on some music, it'll usually be like the Rent soundtrack or something like that, because I'm a big Rent head. But so is my daughter. My daughter's 14. She's not exactly straight, has a lot of friends who are not exactly straight, and so things like Rent and stuff are things they can really latch on to. So that's what we listen to when we're driving and listening to music.
That's cool. And she does she do any theater or musical
She
stuff?
does. She's in a musical theater troupe here in town.
Cool.
She's going to be in a production of Legally Blonde soon. She's a
I've
little bit
seen that
type.
movie.
They made a musical of it, which is kind
Yeah,
of
I didn't know
crazy.
that.
But I so they have it on YouTube, so you can see it. And when she goes to Harvard, there are these three students that she meets that they kind of have a little number they do. One of them is from India, one of them is super duper rich in the States, and one of them's a tree hugging lesbian, and that's who Lily's gonna be. So, yeah, I say tree hugging because it conveys a particular image, not because I'm anti-environmentalism, but
Just call
yeah,
her
sure,
Abby
yeah.
from Swamp Thing and everything will be cool.
Oh,
I was just reading that story again, and I can't believe Alan Moore had her being arrested for having sex with a tree.
wow.
Yeah, that's
That's
amazing.
what every father aspires for her for their daughter.
Well, I guess if you get like a limb sanded down well enough and no splinters, then hey,
Yeah.
whatever.
It was just such an odd thing.
Yeah.
Such an odd thing. It's like the background where they came from, that was no such, and then she skipped bail and took off to Metro Gotham. And that's when Swamp Thing went over there and said, "Where's my wife?" and pretty much just reinvented Gotham for a couple of days. So,
Swamp Thing was one of the characters in the New 52 that I thought got a lot of good spotlight.
I think in the New 52 the magic characters got a lot of good spotlight, like Constantine. I mean, it was very different from the Vertigo stuff. But you had like Phantom Stranger. They made Question a little bit more mystical, and
I
Pandora.
really dug the story behind Phantom Stranger and his early issues of his solo series. I thought were really
Yeah.
great. It kind of
Well,
wandered after a while for me, but.
it was very religious tones, and it even ended in very strongly religious tones, because he was essentially Judas.
Right.
And he carried the coins around his neck, but it was pretty fascinating. I know that man, was it Alan Moore that did it? Somebody did a Secret Origins back in the 80s, and they kind of said, "Here's what Phantom Stranger could be," but they never told you, and they like poked at three different origins for him.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, he's a character that I just am fascinated with on so many levels, like his old stuff, whether I'm reading his what is it, Showcases, or the new stuff, or even the stuff that's in the 80s. I just love him, and he appears in Swamp Thing a lot. He always shows up. But yeah, and then the Demon even had a spotlight. He was in the groups, so, and then you had Justice League Dark focused on all the mystical beings. So they really focused on a lot. I don't think they're going to, but
I like that they brought back Tim Hunter for a story. That made me happy.
Yeah. I'll bring back the Vertigo characters. So, speaking of, it says you used to drive to your girlfriend's late at night. We One of the questions we ask people is, what was your first vehicle?
My dad died when I was junior in high school, so I got his car, which was a 1986 Chevy Nova, which is essentially a blue metal box on wheels. It ran great. I didn't take very good care of it, but the car had over 300,000 on the odometer before it finally kicked the dust. So,
Those cars back then, man, they had some lifespan, I tell you, compared to
yeah,
today.
really, really did. And so that was my first car. The first one I ever bought for myself. Oh, you know what? There were so many little ones that I had that didn't last very long that I don't really remember exactly anymore. I did actually buy a new car as an adult, though. That was pretty cool, getting a Saturn off the lot. But my first car was a
Oh, I
1988
am
Chevy
a
Nova.
fan of the Saturn. I'm
Oh,
just
Saturn was great.
It was a great car. We owned one
The
stick and one automatic. We owned a 91 Saturn and a 94 Saturn. We had two of them simultaneously.
Ours was an 02, and that was just before. Like a couple years after we bought it, they changed the way they made their cars. And I wasn't a big fan of the last few models they did before they went out of business. But that Saturn SL that we had, if I hadn't wrecked it in the snow in Connecticut.
Well, I was gonna say in Florida. Okay.
We lived in Connecticut for 3 years, and I made it through 2.5 winters with no accidents. And then one weekend, I go and visit my friend in Massachusetts, and we spend the weekend together in Massachusetts, and I've got to go to work. And so I get up early to go to work, and because it's snowing outside, I get up extra early to go. And I'm driving down this highway, not like an interstate, but just like, one long straight road down through town. And there's this van in front of me, and I'm probably behind this van for an hour. And we're just driving along, just cruising. It's snow, it's morning, it's having a time. And we pull into a town, and she pulls off to go into a parking lot, and I can't slow down. And I can't, I my wheels follow the grooves of her wheels, and I end up bumping into the back of her car and totaling my Saturn. Pissed me off
Airbag
because
go
I,
off and everything?
huh?
Did the airbag go off?
The airbag, and it wasn't that hard of a hit. It just crumpled up the front, and they wouldn't fix it. They said it was more than the car was worth. I had just put $1,000 into maintenance in that car like a month earlier. It was going to last me 5 more years.
You know why that is because of the safety mechanisms. They designed the frame to fold now. So when the frame folds, it's cheaper for them to give you cash to pay out the Blue Book value than it is to rebuild the frame.
Oh, well, that
Yeah.
makes sense, but it's damn annoying. That was my favorite car I've ever owned, was that Saturn.
But if it was your Nova, it wouldn't have folded like that.
No, that Nova was
I
made out of
get
solid rock.
right. I guarantee it. They would have been able to fix that. Yeah, it's a lot of the safety stuff. Just to, it saves your life, but it hurts your car more because it's designed to fold.
It got over 30 miles to the gallon, which was great back in the day when gas was always over $3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I seem to get in the last year of designs. I had a 94, which had a very sporty look, SL2, and that was the first car that me and my wife bought together, and then I bought a 91 used after that. But I was really happy with the Saturn, and then I right now I have a Durango, and it was the last year of the model that I like, and now they turn into more squares. They used to have a lot more curves, and now they look more like boxes, but seems like I get into the last design that I like every time, accidentally. But one of the other questions we like to talk about is any kind of TV or movie influences that you had that were retro. And I know
Oh.
that I know Star Wars has got to be one of them.
Yeah, although I actually didn't end up sitting down and watching the trilogy until high school. We had them and I'd seen bits of them, but I'd never actually. I grew up with my mom and my dad lived separately, and I never actually sat down and said, let's watch Star Wars. We're constantly quoting movie and TV shows in our house. The Princess Bride
Oh,
is an
classic.
eminently quotable film. Love that movie. The Never Ending Story
I
is a
remember that, but
huge.
I never saw it. I remember the kid flying on this Muppet-looking flying
Yeah, the
dog.
dragon with the dog head. Yeah.
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 I'm not sure why they chose the dog head, but maybe that's just what they had on hand. But yeah, Falcor the Luck Dragon and Atreyu
Ah,
and.
Falcor, yeah. Atreyu, yeah. That's the name that sticks in my head from that
And it was just
for
cool
some
because it's
reason.
like, I read a ton of shit when I was growing up, and this movie is about this boy who steals this book and reads it, and it turns out it's real and he gets to interact with it. And that's every little nerd boy and girl's dream is to get to interact with their stories they're reading. And that was just such a good movie. And eventually in high school, I found out that it was based on a book by a German named Michael Ende, and I got to read that in high school and loan it to a girl I had a crush on, although it didn't get me anywhere with her.
Did you get it back?
I did get the book back. That's all I got. Read it to my daughter whenever we were doing bedtime stories. She really enjoyed it. It's really meta though. Like the movie is based on the first half of the book. And what happens is Atreyu and the princess have to go to the top of this mountain. And at the top of this mountain is this man who is writing the never-ending story as it's happening. So, like the book that Bastion's reading is this book that was written on this mountain. And so the princess says, I need you to help me to save the day or whatever, get Bastion to come to our world. And if you don't, I'm going to make you tell me the never ending story. And so the old man then starts reciting the never ending story, which means he's now reciting the entire book within the book. And like the world's going to fall apart because now they're caught in a recursive loop. And it's very meta. It's very fantastic. And then Bastion actually does what he needs to do to go in and save Anastasia from the nothing and everything else. But yeah,
Are
good
those
stuff.
films that you would see on at the theater, or did you rent them and see them on VCR?
The first one was before before I got to choose what movies we saw in the theater. So I saw that one a whole bunch on tape. They did make a second one that I saw in the theater once because that's all I needed. Sadly, the second, and I believe they've done several Never Ending Story related films, but I saw the second one once, and that was enough.
I can't remember if I've ever seen the second one. I know I've seen the first one probably a couple times. The first time you just brought back to me was at my next door neighbor's house growing up when we were little kids. I have a younger sister, and our next door neighbor was also a boy and a girl. So we would go over each other's houses a lot, and a lot of the Transformers I played with early on, because I didn't have a lot of Transformers, were my next door neighbors. But anyways, yeah, I all of a sudden I remember they had a finished basement, and I had a memory suddenly of sitting in their finished basement watching. We had rented The Never Ending Story and watched it.
I was a huge Transformers fan as a kid. I had so many of them. And now I'm looking back and I'm wondering, because we were kind of poor, and I had some of the big Transformers, and I'm wondering how I got them. And my the family myth is that my sister's Cabbage Patch Kid was bought off the black market. And I don't know exactly what that meant, but that's just kind of what we said. Because Cabbage Patch Kids, when they first came out, they were hard to get and they were expensive. I had some. I looked back as an adult at some of the prices on the Transformers I had, and they were pretty expensive. So I don't exactly know how we afforded that, but loved the cartoon. Saw the film in the theaters. Showed the film to my son last year, and he bawled his eyes out when Optimus Prime died.
Oh yeah.
So that
The
was good
cart the a
times.
the animated one or the
Yeah, the animated film,
okay.
1986, The Rock and Roll Adventure of a Lifetime, I
Yeah.
believe, was the tagline on that poster.
I podcast with another friend, and he is so into Transformers. Like, he's got these glass displays with all of these Transformers in them.
Well, one of the things I thought about picking for tonight was a Transformers story arc from the UK Marvel Transformers comics. But I ended up not going with that one. But that's what I've been reading as an adult, is reading through the Marvel US and United Kingdom comics of the Transformers. And the Marvel US ones are all right. They're kind of hokey a lot of the time, but the UK ones, they go a lot of out of their way to build a saga, and it's good stuff.
Is this the first time that you were exposed to the UK versions, or is this
Yeah,
sec a second?
I saw all the cartoons when I was a kid. I read the US comics as a young adult, and I'm reading the UK comics for the first time over the last year or two. It's a slow project.
That's cool. I might have to look into the UK one sometimes. Because I've thought about reading
Sorry
the
about
US
that.
ones.
The way they would do it over there is they have comics are weekly, or at least they were weekly in the UK. So they would reprint the US books and they'd put like half a book in each issue. But that's still putting out 2 issues a month of reprint from the US, and that's faster than the US would do them. So every so often they would stop doing reprints, they would put out new material that goes in between the stories. So an arc comes to a close from the US, and now you get UK stories that take place between that and the next arc. So if you're reading
I
the
see.
UK, it just feels like one continuous saga.
Were the UK versions licensed through Hasbro, or were they their own thing? I don't know how that works, but.
Well, it was through Marvel UK, so I imagine they worked through the license that Marvel had worked out.
But it's not the same as the G.I. Joe UK stuff, right?
Oh, with Action Force?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that was a different animal.
Okay.
I don't know exactly how the differences worked out, but this was. And I've looked at some of the hardcover collections. They have some behind the scenes stories and stuff. This really feels like they have all the same rights and powers that the US does. They just don't have as much direct control on story direction. And so they'll get, they'll be in story conferences and find out where things are going, and they'll find ways of putting in stories. Like in the build up to the movie, they had this huge storyline that introduced some of the new characters from, because the movie takes place in the future. So some of those characters from the future, they travel back to the 1980s, Galvatron, Hot Rod, Ultra Magnus. And so it's a time travel story that was really, really cool. And that was one of the stories I thought about bringing to the table here. But yeah, Transformers is good stuff. He-Man was a big thing. Thundercats, loved all that. Voltron, really, really enjoyed. Can't watch it now at all, but I really liked it as a kid.
Yeah, I never got into Voltron. I was aware of it. It was kind of one of those things on the periphery that I never really got too exposed to.
I never
Thundercats, I did a little bit.
got into Voltron just because of the style that it was in. I don't know why. It just never appealed to me because it was more in the anime style.
Well, it was a dubbed anime. It was one of the first
Yeah.
dubbed animes we had over here before they called it anime.
And I found it jarring compared to what I was watching at the time. I still find anime kind of
I
jarring.
was gonna say, you don't. I guess you've never
I've
liked
never
anime.
liked it. Yeah, I don't
That
know why.
just
Every
doesn't work.
time I dip my toe in.
Y'all ever watch the new Ninja Turtles cartoon that's out? It's been out for the last 3 years or so.
No.
I know of
Each
it,
season,
but I haven't seen any of it.
they like to watch TV. And so each season, the show that they're watching that we see a lot of changes. Like in the first season, it was a animated Star Trek.
Okay.
And it wasn't exactly animated Star Trek because they
Yeah.
can't just do that, but it was a cartoon that was done in the animation style of Star Trek with characters that looked like they might have been on that cartoon. In the second season, it was a riff on Voltron. And so
Interesting.
you would see Mikey watching Voltron cartoons in the mornings. Now it's some sort of Conan something or other that I thought might
Thunder?
be. Yeah, I think
Thunder the
it's a riff on Thunder.
Barbarian.
Yeah.
Oh, nice, 'cause that was one of my favorites.
So they're watching Thundar. You'll see most episodes. They'll
That's
watch a little bit
the
of it.
current Ninja Turtles?
Yeah, the current Ninja Turtles. It's
That's like a very risque kind of thing to do. I mean, do you mean that the animation style changes with it?
no.
It's
The
something that
in
the
the
characters
show, the
watch.
turtles will watch TV.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. I gotcha. I gotcha.
And so for 30 seconds of an episode, they're sitting around watching TV, and you'll see some clips of a cartoon they're watching as they, cheer on or boo or whatever the events of the show.
But it's
And
a riff off of that, right? It's not like they
right.
get the rights to do it. Yeah.
Exactly. So,
Gotcha.
and it's fun because it's all stuff that we watched as kids, and yeah.
Yeah, that's neat. Thunder. Wow. I'm gonna have to check
That is
that
cool.
out.
If you like Ninja Turtles, the current Ninja Turtles cartoon, you can't go wrong. Although, even though it's US and it's 3D CGI, they do take a few cues from anime. So it might rub you a little wrong, but the kids and I really enjoy it.
Yeah, that's
I think
cool.
most American animation nowadays takes a few cues from anime.
Because anime sells.
Yeah.
Sells a lot.
Yeah.
Any other questions that we missed, Chris?
I don't think so. It probably covers it. Pretty good rundown.
Didn't ask my boss size. That's good.
I have one question for you, just because I'd like to know, because you're such a Superman fan,
Okay.
and you've read all of it. I mean, you've read new stuff, you've read old stuff, you've read Golden, you've read Silver,
Yeah, there's still some big gaps, but
what
I have
are
read a lot.
like three characteristics that you think that you like to see in the character?
Three characteristics I'd
If
like
you
to see
had,
in.
yeah, if you had, if you had, if you were a consultant on Man of Steel or the new Superman franchise, and they wanted you to, because of your expertise in Superman, say, what characteristics do you think would capture the spirit of the character?
Okay. The guy is honest, which is not to say that he never lies, but just that he's always straightforward with people. What you see is what you get with Clark and with Superman. He's not going to try to put anything over on people. Who he is on the inside comes out through his face. That's how he acts to people. He's going to try to do the right thing or the best option available to him. One of the things I think truth has done is limit his options. And therefore, the right thing or the best option is now no longer necessarily a really awesome idea, but it's the best he has with what he's got. So that's there. Also, when you have a lot of superpowers, being able to do the very right thing regardless of consequences is a lot easier than whenever you're depowered a bit. And he's going to stand up for people who are being picked on. He doesn't like bullies. He doesn't like people abusing their power. He doesn't like people picking on other people. There's a scene in Man of Steel where he's in a bar and there's some guys kind of, you know, flirting a little bit too much with the waitress, and he stands up for her. Now he gets beer poured on his head for his troubles, and he walks off the job because he realizes he can't stop these guys without killing them. And plus, they kind of piss him off, and that's another thing that Superman does is his emotions can kind of run a little shallow sometimes. They're a little bit close to the surface, but he does it. He usually does a pretty good job of making sure that he doesn't hurt anybody. But yeah, those are things I think are important to him. You can play with the suit till you're blue in the face. As long as it's mostly blue and the cape is red,
And he's got
I'll
the
be fine.
S.
And he's got the S, you know. But like right now, there's a Superman Lois and Clark, which has the pre-Flashpoint Superman in the Flashpoint universe. He's been here trying to live a life, and his Superman suit's all black with the silver S, like it was whenever he came back from the dead. And I can dig that. It's not the main Superman suit, but it's a Superman suit, and it works. You can play with things like who knows his secret identity and who doesn't. All that stuff is window dressing. But basically, Superman is a good guy, and the only real reason that he's a good guy is because that's what you ought to do. I think of all the characters in the comics, he's one of the ones that is most easily used as a role model, not because he's perfect, but just because he tries to be the best person he can be.
Those are all great answers. In Man of Steel, some of my favorite scenes are when he's a little boy, and they're very simplistic. It's just him, where they're hanging clothes, and that red thing is flying, and it symbolizes to me what I think of Superman, its heart. And I really like how they portrayed the little boy, you know, like when he was in the closet and he's experiencing like, why am I hearing these weird sounds? Why can I see through things? You know, I really dug that part of the film.
Yeah, I really did too. There's a I got to sit down with a friend on a show called Trentus Magnus Punches Reality, and we talked about Man of Steel for 5 hours, and that's coming out over the course of three episodes in March leading up to the new film. So I'm looking forward to revisiting that conversation, and
Very
you should all
cool.
go listen, listeners. Trentus Magnus Punches Reality.
There you go. And what would be your favorite villains for Superman? Like, you've read a lot of Superman. What are some of your favorites?
You can't go wrong with Luthor. Although it's interesting that his popularity was really turned up because of the movies. He wasn't as often used before that. And then whenever they rebooted in the 80s, he was just like a constant thorn in Superman's side in the background,
Yeah,
whether he was directly
he
in
was president too.
he became president at one point, yeah. And let's see. I like Brainiac, but I don't like Brainiac to get too cosmic. Because, you know, have him be a computer mind, have him be a space traveling menace, have him be someone that can give Superman a run for his money. But the stuff they did with Convergence that turned him into this like metatextual, metaphysical being beyond the multiverse that just like protrudes. He's basically a god, really. And that's
You
just,
like
that's
you
a.
you liked him when he was more of like a collector.
I really did like the collector story that Grant Morrison did. I thought that was a great, different, but cool take on Brainiac. And it was immediately, the look that he created in that character was immediately ignored when they started using Brainiac again. He was back to being a green dude with purple dots on his forehead. Which is fine. I'm all for some purple dot green dudes, but I did like the take that Grant Morrison did.
Cool. Any of the any obscure ones you want to put out that somebody might not like that would not know?
What was his name? They actually used this guy in a Superman comic I read last night, and I was like, oh my gosh. I forget his first name. His last name is Wolfingham, which is spelled Wolfingham. And he's just a business guy, right? This is back in the 40s, and he's just a bit of a tycoon. And it's not that he's really that cool of an idea or anything, but it's just like he was a recurring annoyance to Superman in the 40s, and then he disappears completely from continuity, and he showed up in my Superman comic last night. I was like, look at that.
Well, that's
It's.
obscure because probably a lot of people wouldn't catch that. I wouldn't have
Yeah.
caught it.
Superboy had a couple of magician kids. I don't think their names were Heckle and Jekyll because that's the cartoon, but it's something like that, some sort of, rhyming name thing going on. And they're a recurring thing for him in the 40s, maybe into the 50s. I really like the Phantom Zone villains. I really, really like the Phantom Zone in the Silver Age because it's creepy as heck. You've got these Kryptonian criminals trapped in a phantom layer of reality where they can see everything that we do and they can hear everything that we do. We just can't perceive them and they're floating around and they can't age or whatever. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, how many showers are these guys peeping in on? Everything that you'd ever done that you didn't want somebody to see. Yeah, there's a Phantom Zoner floating in the corner of your room watching you. And it's this idea that never got used in the comics, of course, because, Silver Age and Comics Code, and I'm the only one who goes that perverted with things, but I think the idea is a really great creepy idea.
It's something that Morrison could poke at in the future if he ever does some more Superman books.
Yeah, he could. I
'Cause
did.
he does love that stuff. He loves those eras of Superman and Batman.
He did some great work with All-Star Superman, and I haven't read his JLA run yet, but I know he does some good work with Superman in that.
I was gonna say that's a Phantom Zone's that's a creepy punishment, and it's also a pretty severe punishment too. Just
One of
constantly
the
be able to see reality but not interact with it.
And you're basically trapped for eternity. And actually, that's one of the things about the Phantom Zone that has gotten lost is the first time that Superboy finds the Phantom Zone projector, like the very first time they introduced, which was the month before Mon-El got introduced. So much before, immediately before Mon-El, that I almost wonder if they had the Mon-El story idea and then just chose to introduce the Phantom Zone projector 1 month earlier so they don't have to do it all in one story. But the Phantom Zone projector is in a box of forbidden Kryptonian weapons. And the Phantom Zone was created as an alternative form of punishment, and then it was forbidden as being too cruel. And then every time they used it after that, they just forgot that the Phantom Zone was actually shut down. They stopped using it.
It's interesting
So.
'cause yeah, it is a very pretty it's a pretty cruel punishment. So
I mean,
it's
you don't want to
interesting that
chop
they
somebody's.
recognize that but it's just too cool not to use.
Yeah, you don't want to chop someone's head off, but you will trap them in forever in a thing. And some of them had like 20-year sentences. And the first guy who ever got imprisoned, Xatu, was imprisoned in the Phantom Zone, and his day to be released was the day Krypton blew up.
That's a drag.
Yeah,
Talk about
so.
bad luck.
Oh, man.
Jeez.
Who wrote that story? But do you
I don't
remember?
know. Grant Morrison played with it in Action Comics as he brought the character back,
Oh,
but it
okay.
was back in the Silver Age. It would have been either Jerry Siegel or Bill Finger or Otto Binder or one of those
Okay.
guys.
I was wondering if it was like a Kerry Bates. He
Oh
did
no, it
the
was before
letter.
Kerry Bates was a letter hackett this time. He was reading
Yeah.
comics and
Okay.
playing with his Superman underwear, I'm sure.
Very
That's
cool.
funny.
Well, thanks for answering those and have those are questions I had. If Chris doesn't have any more, then we can get into our do you have any more, Chris, or
No, I think I'm good
okay.
to move on.
All right, so we're gonna let you start first. So you can pick two to three things to talk about, and if you want to talk about your first item, the floor is all yours.
I do have two comics that I brought because I decided I should try to go to single issues. Maybe as a bonus, I can talk about an arc that I recently read at the end. But not to go too far from our theme, of course, but I did pull out Superboy 121. And
Cool.
Superboy 121 is from 1965. So I think it fits her
Nice.
retro.
Yeah, squeezing in under the wire.
The format for comics back in this time was to have two or three stories that were usually unrelated, although sometimes you'd have two of the parts taken up with one story and then a second story that was shorter, or you'd have all three parts devoted to one story. So the cover to the comic only portrays one of possibly three stories in there. So on Superboy 121, we see a young Jor-El flying out of a time bubble in Superboy's era. And that's not the story I'm going to talk about. The story I'm going to talk about is a two-parter called Clark Kent's Single Identity. And what we have going on here in this story, it opens up with Smallville. They're celebrating their town's anniversary, because that's what you do when you're in a small town in the 60s, is you celebrate the founding of your town. I don't even know when Jacksonville was founded. It's somewhere back there. And one of the things that Superboy does to add to the festivities is he goes up around the moon and just flies around it so fast that he leaves glowing streaks behind him. And just, sort of like a little visual celebration in the sky. So he gets home that night and he flies. Superboy has a tunnel that he uses to keep his identity secret. He goes into the forest and goes into a tunnel entrance underground and flies through a tunnel under this forest and comes up in his basement in his home in Smallville. So he goes to sleep because it's nighttime. He has to get ready for school the next day. So the next morning he wakes up and he's doing his homework right up to the minute because he knows he can just flash to school really quickly. So he's doing his homework right up to like just a minute before the bell. And he goes to turn into Superboy and fly to school through the tunnel. He jumps in the tunnel and falls. And he has lost his superpowers.
Uh-oh.
So he runs through the tunnel and he's like, oh my gosh, I was bruised by the fall. I have no speed. My school books are heavy. I'm panting. I'm sweating. And he gets to school late and the teacher makes him feel bad. She's like, Clark, I'm surprised. You're late for the first time. It's too bad your perfect record is spoiled. So, Clark's what?
You're a teacher, right?
Yes,
Do
I
you
am.
use that line? Are you gonna use
It's too bad your perfect record is spoiled.
that?
So he's feeling that he's wondering if maybe he passed some red kryptonite and that maybe that took away his powers, but he usually feels a tingling sensation whenever red kryptonite affects him, and that didn't happen this time, so he doesn't think that that's it. So he goes out to PE, and they're doing baseball, and the guy hits him in the head with the baseball. So Clark has to sit down. He's like, even a cannonball couldn't hurt me before, but now with my invulnerability gone, ouch. So he goes home later, talks to his parents. They're trying to figure out. He has this huge list of red kryptonite effects that have happened over the years, and like Fat Superboy and Human Magnet. And his parents keep asking him to do stuff, and he keeps trying to do it without remembering that I don't have powers anymore. Like she's like, I want to vacuum out of the piano now, Clark. He's like, sure, Mom, I'll just lift the piano. And oh my gosh, my superpowers haven't come back. So a day passes, 2 days pass, and red kryptonite always wears off after a day or two. So now that it's gone, he's wondering what's going on. So Smallville's wondering where Superboy is. So he's like, okay, well, I've got to get my Superboy robots out there doing patrol because Superboy has robots. And he goes to the back of one, lifts up the cape to set the dials. He's like, oh, I'm hope I'm reading the control dials correctly because without my usual super sharp eyes. This dial activates them, yeah. So he turns them on and they fly out to space on their weekly patrol because his super brain, no longer super, did not remember to turn off that setting. So
He left the toaster on.
exactly.
He burned the toast.
So the three robots, being stupid robots, fly into a meteor and crash land head first because he didn't tell them what to do correctly. So time starts going by, and Clark does not get his powers back. And the emphasis that is made in this story is how much he now has to be like a regular boy. He helps his father in the store that they have. He helps stocking and everything. And stocking is usually like he just throws the cans on the shelves, but no, it takes him like hours to restock the store now. He sees a fire on a house, and rather than change, he actually undoes his shirt. He's like, "Oh wait, I'm not Superboy." Rebutton the shirt, pull the fire alarm.
The fire department's looking at him. Why is this kid taking his shirt off?
Right? He's walking with Lana as a jewelry store gets robbed, and she's like, "Well, Clark, that's your cue to make some excuse to slip away, change to Superboy, as I've often suspected." And Clark's like, "Okay, yeah, I'll just pull out my police whistle here and call for help." And so he just pulls out his junior traffic police whistle and calls the cops over to catch the bad guys. He's able to get his vaccinations because Superboy never could get vaccinations before, so now he can. He goes in line with everybody else and gets his drugs. He gets into a fight with a guy at school because the guy is saying mean things about Superboy. He's like, "You know, you're only saying that because Superboy's been away for a month and you think you're safe. You're a coward." Dude punches Clark in the face and downs him with one hit. So Clark decides that if he's not super anymore, he's got to start getting athletic because he can't just get beaten up all the time. So he starts working out. He's in the gym. He's lifting weights. He's on the balance beams. He's swinging on rings, doing gymnastics. He's thinking, even if I did gymnastics for a year, I wouldn't end up with a thousandth of my former super strength. But I just want to be in condition to win round two with that bully. Time continues to go by. Lana keeps teasing Clark about being Superboy. And so Clark's like, "Yeah, you know what? I'm just gonna go over here to this barber shop and get a haircut." Because Superboy can't get haircuts because his hair will break the scissors. And so Lana repeatedly is like, "Oh my gosh, he's getting a haircut. He can't be Superboy." This is Lana's problem. Lana will be convinced that Clark is not Superboy, and then 5 seconds later start suspecting it again. And so every month or two, there's a story of Lana thinking that he's Superboy. She was actually really bad about this long before Lois was in the comics. We often associate Lois with thinking that Clark is Superman, but Lana Lang drummed that shtick into the ground before Lana picked it up, before Lois picked it up. Okay, so part one ends with Clark at home in tears because he's lost his superpowers and they're never ever going to come back. And it has been weeks and he's just normal Clark. So part two, again, this is the same issue because they have three story slots, and this is part one and two of a story, and the third story is the cover one with Jor-El. But the second part has Clark running through the rain. He got caught in a downpour and he doesn't have his umbrella, so he's just trying to get home and get safe. And he runs under a tree as lightning strikes it. And the guy's like, "Hey, you fool kid, don't you know that trees attract lightning?" So he never had to worry about that before. And his no longer super body has become vulnerable to a teeny tiny virus. So he gets home and he has a cold and he's shivering inside a blanket and he has his feet in warm water and he's taking some sort of wretched 1960s medicine.
And the medicine gives him diarrhea, and he's like, "What the heck? I've
Probably.
never had this before."
I never had the rods before. And so, he and his dad are driving around. He's all sleepy because he's been trying to get all this stuff done, but he's not getting enough sleep and no longer being super. Of course, he needs his sleep. When a couple of guys who were up to no good saw him driving by in the neighborhood, and one of them has a little handheld telescope, I don't know, periscope or whatever. It's one of those little handheld lens things to zoom in on people. And he says, That's that kid I saw change to Superboy in a back alley last year. Let's get him." And so in their car, they drive after Jonathan's car and force him off the road into a tree, which knocks Clark Kent out in the accident. And the two guys are like, "Yeah, he's an invulnerable Superboy, huh? You should have your eyes examined."
Jeez.
As the two guys are running off, Clark Kent wakes up enough to grab an aerosol can and spray it on their pants legs as they're running off. The police show up, they tow off the truck or the car that the Kents were driving in, and Clark tells the police that he has tagged the guys. The police go and put the guys in a dark room, and sure enough, their pants are covered with glow-in-the-dark paint. That puts them at the
Huh.
scene of the crime.
Interesting that he had that on hand.
Yeah, where did that come from?
Well, their back of their car was full of all sorts of supplies for the shop, and so it was planted there.
Okay.
Very conveniently planted there a panel or two earlier. So now Clark is thinking that the people are really wondering where Superboy is. I've got to do some stuff to make them think Superboy's still around. So he stages a fire in the Kent General Store. And he puts on a Superboy costume and ties a rope to a fire thing, a fire pole,
This
and
sounds like a
swings
disaster could happen.
right. So with full gravity pulling him into a pendulum swing, he swings down, manages to arc around into the doorway of the store, and his thought bubble is, these flames are from a chemical that produces harmless cold fire. Plunging through it makes me look invulnerable. I don't think that's a real thing. I don't think that exists, but it's there. So whenever Superboy is quote unquote blowing out the fire, Jonathan Kent is standing behind him with a compressed air pressure tank. So he's blasting sort of a stage effect where you can't, the people who are in the outside can't see the hose that Jonathan's holding up behind Superboy. So the police are happy that Superboy saved the day. He's going to get an award from the police that night. They hand him the award, but they accidentally fumble it, and they're on a boat when they're handing him the award. They accidentally fumble it, so the award drops into the water, and Superboy, or Clark in his Superboy costume, is like, I can't just go diving down to the bottom of the bay. I can't do that sort of thing anymore. So he dives into the water, swims away, mind you, normal speed, swims away to a nearby pier, rents a deep sea diving suit, goes down with his scuba and air tank and everything into the water, finds the award, finds a lead box sitting up with kryptonite in it that he had happened to throw away from a criminal in some previous story. And at first, he's like, oh my gosh, kryptonite. Then he's like, oh, it's just kryptonite. It doesn't bother me anymore. Huh. I'll just take this with me too. And we see him climbing back onto the police boat, and the current carried my plaque downstream. I had to search for a while. Like, so that's why it took you so long. He goes home, puts away the kryptonite, and then he hears a voice coming out of thin air. Hearken, Superboy. We took your superpowers away, and we can give them back. To find out who we are, use the Phantom Zone viewer in your basement. So turns out the Phantom Zone criminals have hatched this plot to take away Superboy's powers. He turns on the viewer and he sees the phantomish forms of Jaxxer, Cruel, and Professor Vacox. Now, Professor Vacox has never been mentioned before, but Jaxxer and Cruel are pretty standard Phantom Zone criminal fare. Vacox talks about how he was put in the Phantom Zone by Jor-El. And so he helped come with this idea of how to get back at Jor-El's son. We entered an astronomical observatory and focused a concentrated beam of mental force through the telescope. So on the day back at the beginning of the story, whenever they're watching Superboy do the light rings around the moon like Saturn, they send their mind power beam into the telescope, through the eyepiece, up into space, where it hits a passing cloud of red kryptonite dust and a passing cloud of green kryptonite dust and forces them to touch, creating something new, red green kryptonite rays, which of course sufficient to take away Superboy's powers. And so Superboy is like, huh, okay, that sucks. But Vacox is like, we want to get out of the Phantom Zone. Let one of us out, and we'll give you back your powers if you let all of us out. So Superboy does. He pulls Professor Vacox with his Phantom Zone projector. He pulls him out of the Phantom Zone into the real world. And Professor Vacox is like, why should I keep my promise and give you back your superpowers? Ha ha ha! You're not super. I'll capture you and finish you off. But Superboy just still happens to have, from 5 minutes earlier, that box of kryptonite. He opens it up and starts torturing Professor Vacox with the kryptonite pain, forcing him to prepare the solution that will cancel out the red-green kryptonite poison in his blood and bring him back to full strength. He then projects Vacox back into the Phantom Zone. We have one sort of collage panel of him going off and doing lots of Superboy stuff all over Smallville, and he flies back into space to play with Krypto. And the story ends with the next day at school, Clark Kent encounters one of his old problems. Oh, gosh. Now I have to rack my brains for some super gimmick to avoid the chest x-rays that students are being given by the nurse today. Ordinary x-rays can't penetrate my invulnerable skin and would give me away. In some ways, being non-super made life easy. Sigh, the end. So that is... The reason I picked this story is because I was reading it recently, and I've been reading Truth recently, and Superman has lost his powers and is getting them back. And I was like, what completely different ways of handling the same basic story concept?
Yeah, but what if it is the red, green kryptonite dust?
What if it's Savage is found?
That's what I would do.
So it's Silver Age and it's silly, but it's hecka fun to read, and that's why I enjoyed it and wanted to bring it to here.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that's why I love the Silver Age. It's so entertaining.
You started to say something, Mike?
Oh, I just said I haven't read too much Superboy. I've read a lot of Superman and a lot of Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen.
Non-Legion Superboy tends to get overlooked a lot for understandable reasons. I mean, if you like the Legion, you like Superboy in the Legion, then basically everything that you like about that is not present in non-Legion Superboy stories.
And he did have a lot of success in TV because he had that syndicated show with like four different actors before.
Oh, yeah, in the late 80s or 90s.
Yeah, do you remember that?
I was. All of that show.
Yeah.
And they had one actor in season one, another actor for seasons two through four. Anna was the same actress all the way through, Stacy Heiduck. And God, she was beautiful. She's still attractive, but she's, you know, 50. And it's one of those shows that actually gets better as it goes along. Like, they put the first season out on DVD. Mm-hmm. And it didn't have very good sales, and so for the longest time they didn't release any more seasons. But with the actor change of season two and with the storytelling changes of seasons three and four, that show grows in quality as you go along, and it ends before it has a chance to get bad again.
Yeah, I think I still own them, but they're like recorded off of my TV on VCR tape somewhere. they're probably in my storage unit right now. I remember setting my timer to record syndicated Superboy. So I've seen most of them. I think I might have missed the last season.
They did one of the most comics faithful adaptations of Bizarro that's ever been done.
I remember that episode. Yeah, I remember it.
They had Bizarro. They had Bizarro Lana. They did a few of them. The ones that I really didn't like was their version of Mixius Pidlick.
Yeah.
It
had that one actor.
Yeah, what's his name?
Oh,
like,
God, I can't remember Ford his name, but he's in a lot of like comedies, and he plays like a lackadaisical character all the time.
He was in Star Trek Miri. He was in the Miri episode of Star Trek. He was the older boy, and then he was in Scrooged.
Yeah,
he was a bum that dies in the snow in Scrooged.
Yeah,
and he just. I don't know. When he's playing Mixius Pidlick, it's
I
like
forgot, I totally forgot about that actor until you mentioned it. Now it's
some people really like those episodes. I feel like he's drunk when he's performing, not in a good way, not in a Jack Nicholson. I'm more awesome when I'm drunk kind of way. But
that's funny because I know next to nothing about that show, but I've seen Scrooged probably 10 times.
Love Scrooged.
So that's funny.
Yeah, this
I had no idea who you were talking about until you said that he was in Scrooged.
Yeah, this was like an obscure show. Like, it was on, it wasn't even like on Fox. It was like on one of those strange Channel 57 kind of UHF
Well, it was before there were that many networks. It was on,
Yeah.
it was on, it, you know, random stations would buy it, and hopefully a station in your area had it.
Had it, right.
But it was pre-UPN, so it was pre, you know, a lot of the networks that exist now. The Flash TV show was concurrent with it. I want to say the
Okay.
second season of Superboy was concurrent with The Flash.
I don't remember it being that current. That's weird.
I mean, they weren't the same night or whatever, but they were it, whenever Superboy was on the air, one of its seasons is when The Flash was on the air.
Huh.
Okay. So that's funny because we watched The Flash, and again, I wasn't much of a DC fan, but I had seen the Batman movie and really liked it, and so we did watch The Flash. And the only reason I knew the Superboy show even existed was later on when I saw this season one DVD for sale, and it's like, oh boy, I didn't even know that that existed. So that's funny. And I didn't realize they were contemporary.
Yeah, I think I've seen an ad in a comic book recently that has the Warner Brothers Archives is selling it, the old Superboy
Okay.
TV show. Yeah, it is a product of what it was, though. You have to go in with an appreciation for the character and that, because the special effects and stuff were not very good.
The
Yeah.
flying was a bit off, but it was produced by the Salkinds,
Yeah.
who had been involved with the Superman movies. And really, the first season feels like a precursor to the Superman movies. The continuity doesn't work because it's more of a John Byrne take on Superman, where he's not really using his powers until he's a college age. Call him Superboy, but he's in college. What man in college refers to himself as a boy? I mean, seriously. Who does that?
I don't
But he's
know.
Superboy and he's in college. And by the end of the show, he and Lana are working for a paranormal investigations thing. It's just like, why are you still Superboy? You're like 25 years old. That's
Want to
really
go
weird.
next, Chris?
Sure, I can. I don't have anything quite as entertaining as that Superboy issue. But I did something a little different this time. I actually watched a older movie, something that I've had in my Netflix queue for a long time now. And there's some interesting background in this film. It's called The Seven Ups, and it's not related to
The
soda.
documentary?
No, and it's not the documentary either, actually.
Okay.
Because I think what you're talking about was there is that guy who did, like, he
7,
filmed,
14, and 21.
yeah,
Yeah.
throughout their lives as they grew up or whatever. Because actually, I think when I initially was browsing through Netflix and saw the title, I thought that that's what this was. But actually, this movie is related to The French Connection. It came out in 1973 and stars Roy Scheider, who was also in The French Connection. And it has the same director, Philip D'Antoni, who directed The French Connection, also directed Bullet with Steve McQueen. And all these movies are all kind of grittier 70s cop movies. So if you like the other two, you probably like this one as well, though this is probably the least known of the three. But it also relates to The French Connection, is that Roy Schneider in that movie, he plays a character that's based on a guy named Sonny Grasso, who's a real life New York City police detective. And him and his partner, this historic bust that drug bust that they did was the basis for The French Connection. And it's pretty heavily fictionalized, I guess, and same thing with this film. But I guess while they were making this movie, while they were making The French Connection, Sonny Grasso told the filmmakers about this situation where people were kidnapping cops who weren't really cops. So, like, kidnapping guys that were impersonating cops, putting them up for ransom to their criminal connections. And so off of that story, they developed this screenplay. The reason it's called Seven Ups is because, and I had no idea going into the film why it was called that. And maybe about halfway through or so, it finally clicks for you that apparently this squad that Roy Scheider's character is on with three other guys, they're a special task force, and they focus only on crimes that will garner a conviction of 7 or more years in prison. And they kind of use unorthodox methods. Nothing real extreme, but they sort of bend the rules and try to get around issues like warrants and things like that, and try to set up criminals. We're introduced to their methods in the beginning of the film when several of them are undercover, and they sort of stage a fight in the lobby of this antique store because they know that it's a front for counterfeit money running. And so they sort of orchestrate events so that it'll turn out that the counterfeiters are exposed. And the police department is happy with the results they're getting, even though there are some uniform cops that don't agree with the fact that they're bending the rules. So the larger plot comes into play as we're introduced to the fact that Buddy Minucci, which is Roy Scheider's character, has an informant who is his buddy from growing up. Whenever they get together, we're told that by the reminiscences that they have about growing up together, and it's not quite clear what his buddy's current life is like, but you get the impression that at least that he has connections to some criminal elements and stuff, and so that's why he's supplying, that's how he's able to supply the information to Buddy. And so the larger plot is concerning a kidnapping ring that's going on with where higher level, upper echelon criminals, both in the mafia and white collar types, white collar criminals are being kidnapped and held for ransom. And as time goes on, Buddy's trying to put two and two together because a kidnapping happens within the organization that him and his group has their eye on, they're currently focusing on trying to bring down a big kind of criminal bank system. Money lending is what they usually call it. that's being run, and as things progress, one of the members of the Seven Ups gets exposed when he's in disguise as a driver outside of a funeral, and the process of events after he's found out and kidnapped and held, he gets killed, and so things really start to escalate at that point. I won't, or I'll give a spoiler warning here. Skip a minute ahead if you don't want to hear the ending, hear more of about the ending of the film. But it turns out that his informant, his buddy from back in the day, is the one that's behind the kidnappings. He's tried to keep Buddy out of it, but from getting hurt and stuff. But he's trying to make extra money on the side, and so. The last part of the film concerns Buddy kind of setting up a situation to confront his friend, and it definitely is a solid film for fans of like 70s action, 70s cop films. I feel like The Bullet or The French Connection, both those films are known for big car chase scenes, and this one has one as well. It takes place in uptown New York, and with some pretty cool cars, and it's a well done car chase scene. So fans of car chase scenes would definitely want to check it out too. A lot of like 70s New York City is on display as well. The both Manhattan and the Bronx, and it's a lot of on location scenes and stuff. So that's one of the things I like watching 70s films and is seeing the world back then, and New York City films in particular, because it's a lot different than the city nowadays. It's I think the reason it's not as well known is it doesn't have quite the level
Doesn't
of
have Gene
quality.
Hackman,
Doesn't have Gene Hackman, true, or Steve McQueen.
which
You know,
has
and
the
I
Superman connection. See how that
right,
connected?
there you go. You gotta link it all together.
Nicely
But
done, nicely done.
so Roy, I like Roy Scheider, but I don't know, maybe he's not quite as charismatic as the leads of the other films, but
I always think of Blue Thunder. Wasn't he in that helicopter movie?
you know what? I don't know. Let me see here. Yeah, you're right. He was in
And
Thunder. He's not in a lot of stuff.
Jaws, right?
Jaws, yeah, he's in
That's his big thing. That's what I
Jaws, yeah,
remember.
besides that, besides the French Connection,
Blue Thunder was like they were flying an Apache helicopter and police. They're using it for police work or something.
Maybe all the regular
Marathon Man.
helicopters were taken.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, he's been in tons of stuff. I wouldn't say it's on quite the same level as Bullet and French Connection.
Was it released in theaters? Okay.
I mean, it looks like it did well. It had a budget of about $2.5 million, and it made $4 million. So not crazy, but I mean, it was came out in December of 1973.
I have never seen any of those films that you mentioned. I have Bullet, like I've known about that movie, and I recorded it just recently on my DVR, but I haven't seen it
Okay.
yet. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that and French Connection are definitely a lot better known, but and I would say those are probably you watch those first, but if you're looking for something of a similar nature and you've seen those, I mean this is on Netflix streaming. And it's just an easy, it's like 100 minutes. It's just like an easy kind of like Sunday afternoon sort of movie, you know. It's not going to blow you away, but it's very watchable.
Nice. Did they use it? Is it spelled like seven and then ups, or is it? Do they use the number, the numeric in the title?
It's spelled out
Okay.
letters in letters. Seven hyphen ups.
It's not the Uncola.
No.
Ha
There are
ha
no generic
Do you remember that commercial
red
back in the
dots.
day?
I don't remember the commercial, but I remember the tagline, the
Yeah.
Uncola.
The Uncola, and then the guy would laugh. Ha 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 ha. He'd have a really deep voice.
Oh, by the way, Jacksonville was founded in 1791.
There you go. So you should get ready for your town meeting to celebrate.
Oh yeah. Somebody said
They
to
only
me
got
where we were going with that. I was like, yeah, let's we should have a party. 18, that's like, yeah, 125 years.
I'm gonna do what now?
Yeah. All
You only
right.
have like what? Another 70-something years or so, you guys can have your tricentennial.
We
Something to
can
look forward to.
celebrate in
But
increments of
every year is an
five.
excuse for cake, an excuse for glowy rings around the moon, you know.
There you
Yeah.
go. Actually, I've been to Jacksonville a few times because my godparents, who were my parents' best friends growing up, and it ended up moving down there when I was a kid, and so we go visit them a few times while I was growing up. Haven't been down there in a long time, but I have been there.
It's very depending on which part of the city you're in, because we are so big.
Yeah,
Jacksonville
yeah.
is, by land space, it is the largest city in the United States, which means there's good Jacksonville and there's not so good Jacksonville.
Yeah, I don't know exactly where I was at, other than the fact that it was fairly suburban.
Yeah.
So,
So
anyway.
my pick is Birds of Prey number 90. So it's just barely cutting the 10-year mark. Just it's not even. It's in 2000. I mean, a 2006 book. But
When in 2006 did it come out, Mike? Because you've already done this
well,
once,
I'm
as
leaping
you've reminded
forward
us.
by three, maybe 10 days.
See, what he's going to do is he's going to just sit on this episode and not release it until it's been 10 years.
There you go. That's
Just
the idea.
cut this part out, and we release it later in the year.
I don't edit. It's too much work. I had to continue this storyline from the previous episode because I just loved it so much. But this is the in the previous episode, Barbara showed Commissioner Gordon her identity as Oracle, and he kind of like said, "Hey, I mean, I don't." He didn't know she was Oracle, but he did know she was Batgirl, which was a surprise. And they recently took out or put Helena, which is Huntress, in charge of the mafia. And Savant had just thrown the spider out the window because he's been kidnapped and tortured because the calculator is trying to find out who Oracle is because she shut him down recently. She shut down his satellites and stuff, and it drove him crazy.
I
And,
hate when they shut down my satellites.
What happens is Batman comes in to confront Oracle, and she's saying, "Do you realize you shut down the operation? Do you realize what you did with Huntress? You put her in charge of this, blah blah blah." He was like, "You got to shut your team down," and he was very upset. And Oracle and Batman get into it while Commissioner Gordon is in the Watchtower trying to defend his daughter. And what he's realizing is, man, Batman's an asshole.
A bit. He is very bossy.
Yes, he doesn't like to be not in control or not to know what these people are doing, because he feels threatened by it. Like he needs to know everything.
The last time he wasn't in control, his parents died.
Yeah, that's right. He's got to control everything. And it cuts to the they actually go to the floor where they've thrown the spider out, and he's still alive. And she calls Lady Blackhawk, Black Canary, and she says, "Please bring the helicopter to the roof. We need to take this guy to the hospital because he was thrown out the window. So they're going to try to save his life." And the calculator has Deathstroke going after the Birds of Prey. So, and this is like right after Identity Crisis, or close to it. So, like, Deathstroke, if you remember, defeated the entire Justice League. And if I remember correctly, he did like a throat punch to Black Canary so she couldn't do her sound. She couldn't make sound. And that's reflected in this book, which is really cool. Because he actually confronts them. And it's pretty cool because Black Canary is trying to calculate, "I can't beat Deathstroke." So she's trying to use Helena, Huntress, and Coyote, who's Savant's like sidekick, to distract him. And she's counting seconds because she knows if she gives him enough seconds that he's gonna take them all out. But what she ends up doing is sticking two fingers in his good eye. So she just pokes his eye out like really, really bad. And it distracts him enough. And then Lady Blackhawk comes with her guns and starts shooting, and they end up throwing him off the roof, but it's thanks to Savant, because he put a few bullets into him. And Savant has been tortured for several days, so he needs to go to the hospital. But what's really cool about this issue, it has your Superboy moment, where it's kind of like a goofy moment, like you're like, here's Gail Simone doing something that's really strange. As Batman comes to the roof, and Helena pretty much hands Batman this book, and it's like the crime organization or the mafia's, because now she's in charge of the mob. It's like an historical bookkeeping of what they've been doing, and he's like, "Oh my God, where'd you get this? This is fantastic work." So she's happy because she's got like Batman's approval. He's like, "Yeah." And then what Black Canary does is the strangest thing. She plants one on Batwoman. She just tongue kisses him. Just came out of nowhere, and Batman says, "You're a strange woman, Diana Lance." And as soon as that all ends, they ask her, "What was it like?" You know, Oracle's like, "I gotta know what it's like to kiss the Batman." And she said, "It's like a bit like French kissing Dracula, only with less saliva." And she goes, "No." She says, "No, it was kind of hot. Really like kissing your principal while on detention."
That's
So.
not cool. Okay.
And then Calculator at this moment realizes he's been defeated and he's freaking out. Like every person he looks at, Talia walks in and Dr. Psycho walk in, and all he can see is Oracle heads. And everywhere he looks, like he's looking at the TV screens, he sees Superman, he sees an Oracle head. So he's like becoming obsessive compulsive with Oracle, and he hasn't been taking his pills, so he's starting to lose his marbles. But man, it was a really good issue. One thing I really love about Gail Simone and Birds of Prey is like a lot happens in the issues. They're not decompressed. There's a lot happening, and it's like highly addictive. So that was my pick, and I just love that Black Canary just laid one on him, just because she could, for no reason.
Girls can get away with that on men more
Yeah.
than the other way around.
Yeah. The other way around could get you arrested.
It can. Yeah, my wife was watching SVU as I was walking back here, and sure enough.
Called
Okay.
the police? Why did you kiss her? What?
No. Just that was one of those things where there was a situation going on that if a woman had done it to a man, it would have not have been as looked down upon. But if a man does it to a woman, then it is looked down upon. Which I'm not saying that's not the way it should be, but I'm just saying
Yeah.
that's an interesting dichotomy there.
That's very interesting that you mentioned that, 'cause I'm watching a show right now called American Crime, and they're flipping it, the script on that. In other words, it's about a guy getting raped. It's
Okay.
very interesting. So, what do you got for us, John? What else?
Well, X-Men Apocalypse is coming out in this May, I think. And I've been on an X-Men read through, and I've been trying to get through the first Apocalypse story and Fall of the Mutants before the movie comes out. So I've been reading a lot of X-Men lately, so I thought I'd bring one of those to the table. So this is The Uncanny X-Men 185. It has a cover date of September 1984. It came out June of that year, which means right around my 5th birthday. And this is the cover shows a very malicious, evil-looking rogue holding an unconscious Storm up by the lapel of her jacket. Like her body is basically kneeling on the ground in some water, and she would flump over unconscious if her torso weren't being dangled by this jacket. It's a pretty awesome cover, although it paints Rogue in a really evil light that is not at all what's going on inside the issue, except that this issue features everybody's favorite member of the government, Henry Peter Gyrick. This guy is the worst, and he's showing a slideshow. He's got like PowerPoint in like beta mode, showing it to these people, and it's showing a slide of Rogue, and she's a mutant, and she's powerful, and she's the target of their mission for the book. He talks about how she can take people's powers and memories just from a touch. how she at one point took Ms. Marvel's powers and is now superpowered on a permanent basis. She recently was involved in a situation that led to, I don't think it's the death of, but it's the believed death of Michael Rossi, who's a captain or something. And anyways, if she ever got her hands on government agents or government employees and took their memories, that's a security risk. So he has this gun. It has been made by a recently introduced character named Forge, who makes weapons, and is designed to neutralize the superpowers of its targets. It will transform Rogue into a normal human being. At this point, Raven Darkholm bursts into the conference. She is not happy that he's going to be using this neutralizer because it has not been tested. The effects are not certain. We don't know if it could kill her. It could take her powers away temporarily. It could take her powers away permanently. There could be side effects. They just don't know what's going on. Now, readers know, although it's not explicitly spelled out, I think, in this issue, but readers know that Raven Darkholm is really Mystique masquerading around as a government employee. So, Valerie Cooper is in the meeting and she starts calming Raven down. Raven and Val have been kind of friends and co-workers in recent stories. So Raven is a bit, or I should call her Dr. Darkholm because that's what everybody else is calling her, and she is a doctor. So Dr. Darkholm is kind of dismayed that using this gun on Rogue was actually Val Cooper's idea. And they have approval all the way from the Oval Office. So Dr. Darkholm can protest all she likes, but it's not going to go anywhere. Change scene to Xavier's
She's
school for
like
gift.
a mother figure too, right? To Rogue.
Yeah, that's another
So,
thing. It's not just a mutant principal thing going on here,
yeah.
but Rogue's basically her daughter.
Yeah,
And
so that is what she has an initial more reason to be angry.
it's the way Claremont writes. That's not said on the page here. But readers will make that connection, will understand that's going on because Claremont trusts the readers to be smart. Change scene to Xavier's School for Gifted Youngsters, where Storm walks in on the professor doing a bit of a psychiatry session with recently discovered Rachel. Rachel is a redheaded girl. Her whole story has barely been revealed because she's only been recently reintroduced, but she's from the future. She was previously seen in Days of Future Past, and she's now back in time. Although it's not exactly her past, so she's kind of freaked out about it. She's going through some PTSD because she spent all of her life in a world taken over by Sentinels. So she's spending some couch time with the professor, not in a creepy way this time. And Storm calls the professor outside. Professor walks outside with her because he's walking right now. And Storm expresses her concerns about Rogue. Ever since her recent encounter with Michael Rossi, the agent I mentioned earlier, who used to be Carol Danvers's lover, and Rogue is having some sort of like mental collision between her Rogue personality and her Carol Danvers personality. So Storm's just kind of concerned about her. She wants to go after her. She wants her to not go insane. So Professor decides to help her. They're going to go to Cerebro to see if they can track down Rogue. Meanwhile, Rachel goes over to the phone and looks at the nearby phone number list and sees Scott Summers, Cyclops. And she's kind of confused why the phone number is way up in Alaska. It's because Scott Summers had recently gotten married to Madeline Pryor and they're having lots of sex in Alaska. But Rachel just knows that she wants to call Scott Summers, so she calls him. He says hello, hello, and hangs up. She can't talk because she's full of tears. And as he hangs up, she says, Daddy. And that's our first clue as readers of who exactly Rachel is. We know she's from the future. We know she was in Days of Future Past, but who she is still a mystery until it starts to get revealed here. So it's pretty cool. Dr. Darkholm now changes to her Mystique guise. Goes into some secret hidden chambers in the secret hidden government building. where Destiny is hanging out. And they talk about Rogue and about Val Cooper and about betrayal and about what Mystique is going to do. I'm sorry, Raven. The only advice I can offer is that you follow the dictates of your heart. Turns out Mystique actually has a heart. We then go to the operation with the military going after Rogue. Val Cooper's there. They're talking about how the range is pretty limited. They're going to have to get really, really close to Rogue. The Avengers have been trying to find her because of the recent shenanigans with Rogue and the Avengers, which is when she took Ms. Marvel's powers.
And that was in an annual, wasn't it?
Avengers Annual 10. One of my favorite comics of all time.
Yeah, I remember reading that.
That issue made me fall in love with the Scarlet Witch as a character concept.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a really badass Scarlet Witch scene where she turns reality on its head
right.
in an effort to defeat the Brotherhood. It's the Avengers versus the Brotherhood, which just doesn't happen very much. That's when the Brotherhood was still pretty new as a concept. Well, in the 70s relaunch, at least. Mm-hmm. Mystique's Brotherhood, not Magneto's Brotherhood.
Right.
We go to Dallas to the author of this whole problem, Forge, the one who made the gun. And Forge finds out what's going on, and he is not happy. He said, our agreement from the beginning was that my weapons were not to be used under any circumstances until I released them. And the government is going against his wishes with all of this. So he's not happy. He wishes Mystique luck because the gun might actually kill Rogue. He says that he's also going to go after them and try to stop them. And if he doesn't have any luck, then they might just have to find another inventor. And while he's in his plane, he says that he wants to speak to the president. Change scene to Caldecott County on the banks of the Mississippi. You have forests, you have trees, you have a tugboat or maybe a steamboat going up the water with the rotary paddles behind it. And Rogue is in her skimpies, doing a lot of high diving into the water. She gets a lot of cat calls and wolf whistles from the boat, very much approving of her feminine grace. We'll say
they're,
it that way.
They're applauding her diving skills.
Exactly.
They're like, yes.
This is 1984, so the sexualization of women in comics was really just starting. Like, Frank Springer did some kind of good girl art in Dazzler that was pretty pretty sexy. But just the generalized sexiness of women was still becoming a thing. It was not yet a thing. But this definitely, you know, makes us take a couple looks at Rogue if we're of the straight male or gay female variety. And Storm shows up. So Rogue is just hanging out, tanning, relaxing all cool, and did some diving outside of the pool. Whenever she and Storm start talking about just what's been going on, and they have some nice heart-to-heart moments. Rogue expresses some of the concerns about her powers and how all this time with the X-Men, with Xavier, she hasn't gotten any better. She still can't control them. She still can't touch somebody without leeching their strength and mind. And so Storm comes up with the idea of, well, what about a willing victim? You know, have you ever touched somebody who wanted to let you know what it was like inside their mind? And Rogue realizes that she's never done this. So Aurora takes off her glove and offers her hand. She knows that, you know, she's going to feel weak. She knows she might even go unconscious and something might go wrong, but she's willing to take the risk. And so whenever Rogue touches her, she gains the goddess-like awareness of the world around her and the elements and the weather. And she starts playing and practicing, and she makes little whirlpools. She flies around, and the powers start to fade, and she briefly contemplates taking more from Storm, which is an interesting bit of dialogue because it's almost like it's addictive, but she stops herself. And just as she stops herself, she gets laser blasted in the back. which it's not the gun, but it is a gun. The soldiers have arrived. Storm is unconscious on the ground. Rogue tries to fly away, but she's kind of woozy. And the military people start blasting after her. There's some shenanigans and some action. She still has some of Aurora's powers, so that she's still controlling the air a little bit. There's a lot of inner monologuing here. She feels like she doesn't really want to hurt these people, just stop them. And at first she feels like that's an Aurora thought. And then she realizes that the weather abilities have left, and that's actually a Rogue thought. It's one of her own thoughts. She's actually becoming a better person, doesn't want to kill the people. Aurora wakes up. She calms the storm that Rogue has lost control of. And basically everything's okay. They got away from the government people. The tugboat that was on the river that came under threat because of the runaway weather, they save it. And it looks like it was a very nice day for Rogue and Storm when Gyrick pulls out Forge's gun, sets it for full power, and shoots Rogue. Except that two things happen. Forge shows up and knocks Gyrick aside as he's blasting, and Rogue is kind of knocked out of the way by Storm, so that with both of these two things happening, the power leeching weapon hits Storm instead. They crash land. Rogue goes into the water. Storm hits the water closer to the beach, and Forge is able to rescue her. Forge is royally pissed at Gyrick, and he takes Storm back under his care. But Rogue's whereabouts are unknown. She appears to have fallen into the water, possibly dead. And the issue ends with a tease of dire wraiths from the ROM comics that are about to pose a problem in the next couple of issues.
Is this prior to the relationship between Storm and Forge?
That begins next issue. It's the life death issue, and I thought about doing that one, but I want to get the one just before it, because this is kind of a key issue for Storm, because this is where she loses her powers for like 3 years of comics.
Right. She becomes a leader too.
A leader with no powers.
With no powers, yeah.
And this is definitely Mohawk Leather Jacket Storm.
Yeah, and you got the Morlock storyline and all that stuff coming up, right?
Yeah. The mutant massacre with the Morlocks.
Yeah.
We've already had some Morlocks, including an almost wedding between Caliban and Kitty Pryde. But Storm has really been getting a lot of attention from Claremont in the comics. And this was a big issue for her.
Yeah, she's one of my favorite Marvel females.
It's just a really good read, because it's a perfect day for Rogue. And Storm and she really get a bond going, and they've established trust. And they're saving the boat, and they're gonna go back to the mansion, and it's really, really great.
Mm-hmm.
And then Storm's powers are leached away.
So what's interesting is I've never read this particular issue, but I've read, I think, the next one and a few other ones. So what's interesting here is the relationship between Forge and Storm formed on this, because it's kind of weird that his gun is the one that did that.
Yeah, and a lot of their romantic overture is done before she realizes that fact.
Mm.
So she's waking up in his house and coming to consciousness, and, you know, he's sexy Native American with his, you know, short shorts, and they comment on the fact that she's been stripped of her powers. He's missing a leg and has a prosthetic leg. Lots of other stuff, and then he gets a phone call and takes it in the other room, and while he's doing that, she decides to call and check in with the mansion, picks up the phone, it's on the same line, and overhears a conversation where it's revealed that Forge designed the gun. And yeah. So all of her love and trust and growing feelings for Forge basically get polarized the opposite way.
That's interesting. Yeah. My biggest weakness in comics is the X-Men because I've always dipped my toe in. I stick with them for a little bit and then I leave. But I do know a lot of the storylines because because I've come in and out, you know.
Right.
I just miss this piece. Like I miss this piece, which seems like a key thing with their relationship that I guess I didn't realize.
It's a big deal. And my X-Men experience has been a bit limited. Like I saw the cartoon as a kid, but it was always a bit intimidating to try to dive into all the X-Books that were out there. A couple times whenever they've done like a publishing launch, I'll try to wade in. And I really loved the Bendis All New X-Men run, or what I read of it. But doing a whole read through of the entire thing is something that's been on my list for a while, and I'm making my way through. But they're probably my second favorite Marvel concept behind Spider-Man, with Captain America as third.
Yeah, I have weird ones. I read the entire run of Defenders and Champions, so those guys
Oh, Champions is good 70s comics. That's
yeah,
good stuff right there.
they hold a special place in my Marvel heart. And then I love Black Panther and Daredevil. Those are my gateway characters. So yeah, that was a powerful issue there. Makes me curious. Like, I wonder if my brother has this. I'd buy it off of him because he doesn't care. But I'm curious to see if he has that issue. I'd like to read it myself.
Yeah, I actually have an X-Men shirt on right now, which I wasn't even really didn't even really realize, but I got up for a second there because you might have heard that I knocked over some water, so I had
Oh
to go
no,
get a
so you have
towel
to
to.
spill it. Yeah.
Can't
I thought it was a 12
take you
year
anywhere,
old.
Chris.
Yeah.
I know. I'm making a mess over here. You
He
guys trying to talk
got
about
a little
comics.
excited when you were talking about Storm Rogue diving into the water in her bikini. He was like, "Oh man."
You know, she looks really great, Chris, if you're a drawing.
And not only that, it just brought back all those memories of X-Men and Spider-Man comics when I was growing up at that prime age. Because you're talking about that being the beginning of it. And by the time I started reading comics, that had already begun with Jim
Yeah, by the
Lee
time you get into the early 90s and Jim Lee and everything, and Image, sexualization of women is definitely, one of the key things that's making comics sell so much that Marvel's
Right.
putting out swimsuit issues. But
Exactly.
I own
10
some of
years
those.
earlier is. What's that?
I own a few of those.
I don't want to know what condition they're in. I really don't.
Yeah. Good or
But.
BG. BG or lower. No.
Yeah, I didn't even realize until I got up to get the towel to clean up the water that I was wearing an X-Men shirt. I saw myself in the mirror.
Is
Not
it
that I can't
Rogue?
just look down, but is it what? No, it I think it might be from around the yellow and gold or teams, blue and gold, because it has Beast, Gambit, Cyclops, and Wolverine on it. It's not that great a shirt. I mostly use it for sleeping in or hanging out
Yeah.
around the house. But yeah, that was
This is the "What are you wearing?"
this.
segment.
Yeah.
I'm
And
wear I'm wearing
I also have
Avengers.
on.
This, go ahead. I don't know. I didn't think you were gonna get into your tidy whities.
Well, until I wasn't going to, but then I didn't realize I kicked off a segment, so I
So
thought
you're
I was
like, I'm
supposed
gonna
to
go further with
finish it up.
this.
It's like, well, I have jeans on and some slippers. My socks never
I didn't
match.
realize there was a dress code. I don't usually podcast with pants.
No, I didn't want to make anyone feel pantless. That's what I happen to have chosen.
I only have
Okay.
pants on because I walked my dog, so I don't walk her with no pants.
That's
Well, I'm
probably
sure your
true.
neighbors appreciate that, but
Yeah.
if you're inside, if you're just at your house, pants are annoying.
Well, my shirt says Avengers Assemble on it, and it has Goliath, Yellow Jacket, Wasp, Vision, Thor, Black Panther, Black Knight, Iron Man, and Captain America on it.
My shirt is half of Darth Maul's face, and the other half is the kind of in the shape of his face are the words, "May the Fourth be with you."
Oh, nice.
So
So
it's
you
a
can
May the.
see what we all wear. We're
It's a
nerds.
May the Fourth shirt.
On February 21st.
That's right. So what do you got for us, Chris?
All right. Where did my comics go? That was quite of a destructive event. They didn't get in the water, but they got knocked down because of the whole commotion. So I had to
How did
go.
you
Glad you
knock
didn't
the
get your
water
comics back.
down? Did it involve the pets, or was it
No,
just...
I was actually leaning in that direction to try to plug something into the outlet nearby, and I forgot the cup was there. I think my shoulder hit it or something. So, yeah.
I just hope it wasn't on that Silver Age comic.
No, I don't know if I have any Silver Age comics.
Well, you have Bronze Age, and
I know I have a lot
I
of
know you're
Bronze Age.
reading New Titans right now, so
That's what I went to
I'm
pick
like,
up. I went
no,
to look
number
for
five.
the issues of Teen Titans I had up next to me and didn't see them sitting there. So then I looked over on the side of the couch and they were on the floor, but thankfully we're spared the water.
Yes.
They're not the greatest copies. They're not terrible, but I don't really want them to be
Be
waterlogged.
water damaged.
Yeah. But these aren't worth as much as the earlier ones I talked about, thankfully. This is 5 and 6. And
Still early on in the new Teen Titans.
yeah. The value just drops off a lot after 1 and 2. But
Okay. Are the kids going with you or staying here?
I'm gonna stay here.
Okay.
New Titans. Number
Yes.
two is Deathstroke. That's the one that's
Right.
expensive, right?
Yeah. That's the most expensive, yeah.
Sorry about that. I thought I was muted whenever I was talking about wife for a second there. Sorry about
Not a problem. You
That's okay.
probably hear our dogs going crazy every now and then.
Are you comparing my wife to your dogs?
Wow, Mike. Trying to narrow down our list of people that want to come on the show, huh?
The
Like, I retract my request. I do not want to be insulted or have my family insulted. So, in the background of the first 4 issues, this whole thing has been going on with Raven and Trigon. That's really her reason for getting the team together. And
Can I
the
interrupt you for one
first.
second? Because with
Yeah,
my
sure.
wife, I missed what issue we're doing. Is this like an early New Teen Titans issue?
Yeah, issues. I'm going to talk about issues 5 and 6
The Marvel
of. I've been
one.
reading that to my son. It's my first time to read it. I just read this issue. Go for it. Go.
That's funny. Yeah, I mean, this is kind of. Last year, I did a podcast called From Kid to Flash, where I started out with Wally West's very first appearance. And I followed that throughout the year. I got to the launch of the new Teen Titans. And then, sort of to save myself some time for other projects, I ended the show, but I've continued to cover the comics here. So I'll be covering New Teen Titans for a while until Wally leaves the team. I'm tempted to just go into a lot of detail because these are great comics. But
So good.
yeah, and my experience of them might be similar to yours is that. I did read X-Men growing up, but I didn't read Teen Titans. But then discovering Teen Titans as an adult, it's just discovering that there's like a whole nother batch of comics that have sort of the same level of quality and
Well,
appeal.
DC and Marvel realized that, and that's why they got
Yeah.
New Teen Titans and Uncanny X-Men crossover.
I'll eventually talk about that, which I mean to this day, looking at that comic, it's especially now that I'm a new Teen Titans fan as well, just even paging through that comic, just like, oh my God, the characters, they're together on the same page. It's the X-Men are talking to the Titans. But anyways, so yeah, this whole Trigon thing's been building up, and interestingly enough, nothing against Kurt Swan, actually nothing at all against Kurt Swan. I really like his art, but it's interesting how the timing fell that there's this great buildup, and the first time we see Trigon fall on the page, and it's not George Perez that's doing the art on this issue. So depending on how you feel about the two different artists, I don't find it that. I know some people are particularly disappointed that Kurt Swan did this issue. I still find his art really good, and I don't think he's worlds away from Perez. And I think that the reveal of Trigon is in his full form is still a pretty powerful splash page, 'cause especially at this time of day, they or time of year or time in comics, they were using splash pages a lot more sparingly, so they had a greater impact, especially if you're reading a bunch of issues in a row.
Yeah,
But
splash pages were
Trigon
actual
lives.
like things that happened that were special.
Yeah, they were really reserved for big moments, and if you're in Trigon, seeing Trigon in full for the first time, it's definitely a big moment, and he's a huge character in stature, so it was a good choice to use that. Specifically for Wally, while Raven is in the other realm struggling with some demons, we do see some fallout from Wally having revealed to him by Zatanna of the JLA of all people that his emotions were played with, and Raven forced him really to join the team in the first place and go back on his wishes to focus on his college studies. And so it's an interesting flip-flop where for several issues, Wally has been vehemently defending Raven to all the team members, and then they're put in a particular an awkward place of having to try to settle him down, and his frustration, his anger, and he's directing it back at himself as well, and feeling like a puppet. And so there's definitely a lot of tension, especially between him and Robin. Robin's the one, because he has the tactical mind, has been most critical of Raven and the way that she's been acting, and so he was a recipient of a lot of Wally lashing out against Robin's criticism of Raven, and now Raven is the one, or Robin is the one, always sort of even keeled, trying to get Wally to come back from his anger. So there's a lot of, it's an interesting dynamic there, and Cyborg and Donna Troy are nearby, just trying to keep things from really blowing out of proportion. And at this point, Cyborg, they don't know each other very well, so it's interesting to see Cyborg come between Robin and Kid Flash, who have known each other for a really long time, and the rest of the team don't, the original four, if you want to call it, aren't entirely, they haven't completely gelled and don't know Starfire and Raven and Cyborg that well. And I like that the writing reflects that. That they're not just all of a sudden all best friends, and it's acknowledged that continuity is kept intact, that some of these characters are new to each other and don't know each other very well. Just as we see, Starfire is the one that comes in and talks to Wally about emotions. How on Tamaran, she was the one, or on their planets, their emotions and their passions that control them, the way that human beings tend to use their intellect and rationalize and work around their emotions. And she's the one that Starfire tells him, I've sensed a lot of tragedy and sorrow in Raven, and tries to get him to see things from her perspective and not just rage and anger. But maybe with not the best timing, Raven's soul self contacts the team because the threat is real now and Trigon and his forces are invading their dimension. Wally doesn't want to hear any of it, doesn't want to hear any more lies, and pretty much wants her to leave. The rest of the team, trying to make the best of a bad situation, decides that they're going to go try to help her, even if they're not quite sure of the situation. They got to do something about it. Interestingly, Wally is upset enough that he decides to stay behind, and Cyborg does as well. And Cyborg tries to empathize, really, with Wally about the fact that they've made a choice to stay behind and that Raven has been playing them as fools. And Cyborg tries to give him a shoulder, basically telling him and he actually kind of does like a not so quite tough love, but he kind of points out Wally's conflict by saying things out loud that while he's thinking himself to try to get him to sort of work through the emotions in a way. And in effect pointing out that, yeah, you're upset by what's happened, but the threat level here is to the extent of that Raven might be killed. So, and ultimately Kid Flash decides to go into the fight because, you know, he's crying, and what he hates about all this whole situation is that emotionally nothing has changed. He intellectually understands the situation, but emotionally he's upset, but still cares about Raven, and whether that's his real emotions or it's still just the effects of her spell on him, it's not really clear. So he takes off to join the fight. So yeah, a lot of description there and a lot of drilling down into a few pages, but for the character, for Wally, it's a very pivotal time in the character's development. But obviously he's Kid Flash. It doesn't take him long to get into the fight. And after all that, you know, emotional stuff, we get a few pages of the Titans taking care of some of the demons that have come along with Trigon, and the threat level here is not too tough for them to take care of, but when Trigon himself appears, it's a whole nother story. That's where we get there's several panels of him coming forward through the red clouds while his daughter Raven is beseeching him to turn back. And then there's the splash page of him standing, Raven on her knees before him to try to plead with him. And, you know, things at first here, you know, this threat level with Trigon is really pretty intense, and quite a challenge for a young team of teenage superheroes. There's a period where they're kind of regrouping back at Titan's Tower, which they still don't really understand the origin of their new headquarters yet. But Raven does as she's done many times and disappears, heads to the Temple of Azerath, to try to find answers, and Wally at this point is just at the breaking point, really. And again, interestingly, Robin is the one that's trying to talk him through his anger that, you know, that she must, Raven must have her reasons for disappearing. There's still so much that we don't know about her. And but Wally's at the point where she, even if she has her reasons, she doesn't really care what they are. And he states that once this battle with Trigon is over, he's quitting the Titans as fast as he can. But Wolfman and Swan do a neat bit where they kind of heighten the level of the challenge by having a panel of six of the Titans. Each one of them has their own individual panel with a large caption, kind of talks about where they are emotionally as they head into this battle. And I feel like it kind of creates that feeling of like this is a momentous moment, like they're really heading into something that is a huge challenge. And for Wally, it talks about how he's racing ahead, torn with doubts, and he was wanting to live a normal life as Wally West, but his powers have always prevented him. I'm quoting from Finding the Peace He Desperately Desires. And so there's something like that for each of them, save Raven. But yeah, Trigon, as expected, makes pretty quick work of the teen heroes. Each one of them kind of they run at him and are defeated pretty easily. He causes Wally to spin uncontrollably into the earth toward its core, and that pretty much takes Wally off the scene very quickly. There's a sequence of events in Azrath with Raven and her mother, and things escalate to so the battle continues. They kind of regroup, come back, and the issue ends with Raven making a sacrifice.
Nice.
Sorry. Couldn't mute it. It just kind of came out, and
That's okay.
I was going to pretend it didn't happen, and then it
It
did.
did a really good job. You broke the tension between the mother and the daughter.
That's what I'm here for. That's why you invited me.
Breaking
You
the
broke
tension.
the tension.
Yeah, you can't. Mike will not let you let that pretend that that didn't happen. But yeah, poor Kid Flash. Basically, he watches Raven sacrifice herself. Essentially, she tells Trigon that if he stops fighting her friends, she will join him and leave the Earth dimension behind. She will go with him and be at his side as his daughter, basically give in to the demonic side of her parentage. And while they're impressed with her bravery, Wally yells as she's leaving, "I don't want you away from me. I want you here. I want you to know how much I love," he starts to say, but by that point she is gone. And so we see that in a lot of ways Kid Flash is just as deeply conflicted as before. So I'll stick with just issue five, since even skipping over some of the stuff in these issues, and quickly summarizing some of the pages, it there's a lot to say, especially with so much going on with my focus character Wally. But so I'll hold off, and we'll get into the rest of the battle with Trigon and the return of George Perez next time.
Well, I haven't read six yet, so I'm not going to complain with your decision there.
There you
So
go. Yeah, that works out. I won't spoil it for you.
that's a coincidence.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, John, you read it really recently, so it's fresh for you. What did you have anything to add? Anything that stood out to you?
Well, my Teen Titans experience is pretty limited, and I'm reading this with my son, who comes at it from a I've seen the 2003 cartoon and I've seen the Go Teen Titans Go series,
Yeah, very different.
which very of course very very different tone, and I'm not one of those that's going to
Definitely.
bash on the cartoons that are aimed at the young boy audience because obviously they're not aimed at me. So I can't judge Teen Titans Go as a 37-year-old male whenever it's aimed at the 7-year-old males and younger.
No, I think they do a good job with them. I don't have a problem with the cartoons,
But the comic's been really interesting, really engaging, and yeah, Wally does not want to be here. He's only here 'cause Raven's hot. And I mean that's belittling his feelings a little bit, but that's
know.
where our feelings go as males.
It's the legs. It's the legs. He just can't take his eyes off the legs.
It I
has to
was
be. You can't really see too much
confused
of her.
because I thought Trigon had six eyes in my head, and I feel like I've always seen Trigon having like three on each side rather than just two on each side. So maybe I'm misremembering, or maybe it's
New 52.
has the look changed? Is he six-eyed
I don't
now? And
remember because
sure.
Trigon and his sons have appeared in Phantom Stranger because he actually did go have to
Right.
gamble with them. I don't remember.
And that led to an arc in Teen Titans, which I did an episode on a few months ago, and I really wish I had read this first, because the New 52 Teen Titans story that had Trigon in it had Simon, had Raven, had Kid Flash, and it did like new takes on some of these dynamics. And
Yeah. Interesting.
I wish I had had this in my brain when I read that and did that episode, too, when I talked about the similarities and differences. But no, this is good stuff. This is good comics. I like the character dynamics of this team. I like how they're kind of reluctantly together. Even the
Yeah.
old team only is back together, kind of because, not because they really, really want to be.
You mean the original Teen Titans as well,
Yeah.
or yeah.
Yeah, like Wonder Girl, Robin, and Kid Flash. Of course, Aqualad's not
Oh.
here. But Wonder Girl, Robin, and Kid Flash, they're only kind of here. None of them really wants to be here. Kid Flash, most of all. So the team
Yeah.
is interesting. Cyborg doesn't like Beast Boy. Beast Boy
And
can't keep it in his
that's what's
pants.
cool though, because if you know what's coming, that's one of the best relationships.
And I don't really like I know some of the shape of New Teen Titans because I've heard about different stories, especially with the high points like Judas Contract and stuff, but the details and the actual journey along the way I don't really know a whole lot about, so it's been fun to read these with Keenan and just kind of
What did
explore
he
this whole.
think? That's a darker, that's a big jump in storytelling technique from Teen Titans Go. I mean, you still get the personalities of the characters in a different light.
Right. And he's seen the regular Teen Titans cartoon too. But one of his big complaints is just, Robin doesn't have his staff. And Kid Flash shouldn't be on the team. Wonder Girl shouldn't be on the team. And why are they calling Beast Boy Changeling? And Raven needs to be nicer because she's mean in the show. But. Or did he say that she needs to be more mean? I forget. Yeah, she needs to be more mean, and Starfire needs to be less mean because Starfire, blows people up and kills people, and she doesn't do that in the cartoon. So, he took some issues with the structure of the characters, but he's really into it. He likes it. He will not read Haney Teen Titans. He's like, nope, that's too different.
Oh, I just got the Teen Titans first appearance recently in Brave and the Bold.
Wow.
You have your own copy of 54?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I also bought the first appearance of Wonder Girl too.
Like the old Wonder Woman, whenever it's young Wonder Girl.
Oh no, this is the first Donna Troy as Wonder Girl as a Teen Titan.
Okay. Yeah. I've been reading some Silver Age Wonder Woman. It is not great, but Wonder Girl is the highlight of the series. When they do a Wonder Girl strip instead of a Wonder Woman strip, it's like, yes,
I love the
this is
Wonder
better.
Woman stuff. I'm very different. I love the Silver Age Wonder Woman. I especially love the backups, like how to get married and all this stuff. It's great. How do you get married in different cultures? How you should treat a man? I mean, it's
Yeah,
intense.
those are neat little info pages. That's one of the cool things about the Silver Age DC is all the info pages
Yeah, it's like
that they'll throw in.
flashbacks. You get in a
Right.
detective, you get like how fingerprints are done and all this cool shit.
Superman doesn't get those. Superman gets how to behave PSAs and
Yeah.
multiculturalism, which is also cool, but not quite as awesome.
Well, my next one is I've been doing DC like crazy, so I threw in a Marvel. I was glad that you threw in a Marvel too. But I did Black Panther number 8. It was one that I was missing in the collection with Jack Kirby. He actually wrote it and drew it. And it was a good issue. There's some really good splash pages, and he's inked by Mike Royer, which tends to be the more popular inker for Jack in terms of his DC stuff. This takes off from it gives a lot of backstory how like Black Panther got the mantle. He had to actually fight his way and win the mantle, and then it was almost like the Wonder Woman story. Like if you remember, she had to pretend to be something else because her mother didn't want her to.
Didn't want her in the games,
Yeah,
yeah.
didn't want her to go out into the world of man. So didn't want her in the games. That's kind of like what he did. He wore a mask and fought his way through and actually got the mantle of Black Panther. And this takes place where he's actually leaving, and he runs into this boat where he finds two stranded people in the water and picks them up. I think he was on his way to like Avengers Mansion. This is the time like when he was an Avenger and stuff. And he picks up these guys and immediately realizes because he's T'Challa is like really well informed. He's like a really, really smart man, even in current Marvel continuity, like New Avengers and stuff. He's one of the greatest minds. He's one of the best leaders. You know, Wakanda has, through his leadership, has remained uninvaded until like Doctor Doom took over in a 4-issue miniseries. But he's held off Atlantis. He's done a lot of different things with his nation, and he's still been able to protect the vibranium and all that stuff. So he picks up these mobsters, and then they're trying to convince him to take him somewhere else. And he goes, "No, I'm going to drop you off at the nearest island because I'm not going to go out of my way to." And he says, "I kind of know who you are." And the guy pulls a gun out and says, "No, you're going to take me to this island. Do you know who I am?" And he says, "Yes, I know who you are." And they end up crashing the plane. They pull their guns out. They shoot the plane up. Black Panther puts on his hood and starts fighting them. They crash the plane. It looks like the two one of the guys is dead, one of the mobster guys, but he takes the other guy to try to save his life. And then the other story arc is he has a stepbrother, which I don't remember this guy ever mentioned before, but this stepbrother actually went to the vibranium mines, and the radiation from the vibranium turned him into like this monster. He looks like some kind of lava monster. And he's been attacking the family and attacking Wakanda. And one of the leaders of Wakanda, in T'Challa's absence, goes to get the family together. And the family's kind of outrageous looking. I mean, they look definitely out of the 70s, the way they look. You know, one guy's in a purple suit. He's really smart. He's got a relative that's really, really large, woman. And then he's got like one cool brother who's like the athletic type and a father guy with a monocle in his eye. And he convinces these guys they have to work together to fight his stepbrother. And that's how it kind of ends. They basically fight off the stepbrother. He gets away. And T'Challa's carrying the body of this gangster. really cool Jack Kirby art. Me and Chris covered like every single Fourth World DC book except for like the Demon. But Mr. Miracle and the New Gods and Jimmy Olsen and everything. And the art in this is fantastic, Chris. You'd love it. I mean, it's really good. You get some cool splash pages, especially when he's fighting.
Yeah, I really got to get around to reading that stuff that he did when he went back to Marvel,
Yeah.
including Black
I read his
Panther.
Captain America run.
Yeah, I got to read that too. I've
It's
looked at some of the art.
you really should drop some acid before you read it.
We're well aware of his stuff, though. We've he tends to write very out there stories,
Trippy,
especially when he went to DC. I mean, you read Forever People. I mean, it's pretty out there and trippy.
yeah. He wasn't a hippie, but I guess he liked hippies.
Yeah.
He liked to include them in his art or in his stories and stuff. Hippie influence. But
What a fantastic creator, though. The worlds he creates is just on the page, they just look so dang good. So, do you have a third choice that you want to talk about, John?
I was going to share some thoughts on something I've finished reading recently. This isn't going to be like a detailed look at a single issue, but I recently finished up the original run of Captain Britain, like the Marvel UK weekly Captain Britain. I just recently
Just
finished that run, which I had never read before, and I'm reading it because to go along with my X-Men reading, whenever Captain Britain merges with the X-Men to make the Excalibur book, being I know y'all don't know me that well, but I have to do things a certain way. My brain sort of tortures me sometimes with how I must do certain things. So I have to read all of, if I'm going to read Excalibur and Captain Britain's involved really heavily, I really need to read all of Captain Britain first. So I did. I started with, Captain Britain number one from the 1977 and worked my way through his 40 odd issues, and then the Captain Britain comic. Marvel UK was a very fluid publishing structure. They would constantly introduce titles, merge titles, cancel titles, just to see what was making money. And very little of it was new content. Most of it was reprint content, but Captain Britain was new. And in Captain Britain, each issue would lead with a Captain Britain strip. And then behind that would be like the Avengers and other stuff. And after 42 weekly issues, they merged Captain Britain with their Spider-Man comic. And it became Super Spider-Man and Captain Britain was the name of the comic for like 20 issues. And so you have Spider-Man doing some reprint strip from an amazing issue. And then you'd have Captain Britain, and then you'd have some other reprints in the back. So again, Captain Britain is the only stuff in this comic that's new, which is why he's on the headline cover, even though Spider-Man's actually the more popular character. And Spider-Man usually took the cover art. Captain Britain rarely appeared in the cover art. But the strip was interesting. It's one of those things, reading a weekly serial comic is kind of an odd experience, especially when you pay close attention to things like the passage of time and just how long it's been since this story started, because you only get 8 pages per issue and you've got to end on some sort of dramatic cliffhanger. So, unless you're wrapping a story. So there's the way they would tell the stories is just kind of odd. And anyone who follows soap operas is kind of familiar with this idea where, I'm not really entirely sure how long we've been in this day, this day of events. We had morning, and a whole lot's happened, and we're not at lunchtime yet. So, but Chris Claremont was the first writer. He wrote the first 10 installments of Captain Britain. And Captain Britain is Brian Braddock. He's a university student who is, I forget the exact scenario, but he's in the situation where he's out on the countryside And there are these two things. There is a sword and there is an amulet. And he's being chased by someone mean. And he has the choice. And then, like, Merlin appears in the heavens. You must choose between the amulet and the sword. The symbol of life and the symbol of death, or something like that. And Brian Braddock, being a pretty upstanding guy, decides to go for the amulet and not the sword. And by grabbing the amulet, he is given all the powers of England and Merlin. And he becomes Captain Britain. And so to go back and forth, he rubs the amulet and becomes Brian, or rubs the amulet and becomes Captain Britain. And his body, his physical carriage is significantly different. Like he grows more muscular, so that to look at Brian, you would not think he was Captain Britain just because they don't have the same build. After Chris Claremont leaves the book, it's taken over by, oh gosh, I'm blanking on the writer's name, but what he does is he turns it into a Captain Britain, Captain America team-up story for like months. It's still Captain Britain. It's still Captain Britain on the cover. It's still Captain Britain in the strip title, but he does a Red Skull story where Red Skull, there's this computer that Red Skull is going to use to take over England. He's going to finally conquer England for the fatherland, for the Führer. He's going to finally conquer the Isle of Britain, and of course Nick Fury finds out about this and calls Captain America in. So you have Captain America, you have Nick Fury and Shield playing a bit of a backseat to the story, but they are involved. And that is where you introduce Strike and Lance Hunter, who viewers of Agents of Shield will recognize from the second and third seasons of that show, being
Oh,
the British
jeez,
character.
I had no idea that he had any sort of
Comics connection?
previous comics connection. Yeah, I just
Oh
thought he was
yeah.
like a thuddingly dull replacement for Hawkeye.
Well, he's a bit of a British replacement for Nick Fury.
Gotcha.
And so he is the head of STRIKE, which is an acronym. STRIKE is also the name of the group of agents led by the guy who's going to be Crossbones in Captain America: The Winter Soldier. That's his strike team, and it's not just a strike team, it is a strike team of agents that go up, that try to take down Captain America in the elevator. So anyways, so yeah, Strike and Lance Hunter both have origins in UK comics. So yeah, that story with Captain America and the Red Skull lasts for months. I want to say that the Red Skull first appears in the shadows of issue like 15, and it's something like issue 35 or something before the story finally wraps up. So that's weekly installments. So it's a long story, and it's a lot of it is really, really good. Red Skull bombs the Braddock Manor with both captains in the basement, and for an entire issue, none of your heroes appear. And you just have everyone thinking they're dead and moving on with the story and trying to figure out what to do now. Red Skull's gleeful, Shield and everyone's sad. There's even a scene, I guess they put this in there just because they have to have the characters in there. There's a scene where Dum Dum Dugan has Captain America and Captain Britain fighting in an arena, and Nick Fury walks in and is like, "What the Sam Hill is going on here?" And turns out they're LMDs, life model decoys made up to look like the two captains, so they're not actually in the story. Dugan's like, "I'm sorry, I didn't realize it'd make you upset. Best friend just died." And
Do you know if these
so
were a magazine format or were they like regular comic size?
I don't know the dimensions of British comics. They didn't have anything in the way of text stuff like the American Marvel magazines did. And they're not that long. They're still about 32 pages. So I
Okay.
don't think their dimensions were anything too unusual, unless maybe the British publish with different dimensions compared to
Were
us, which
they
I think they
even
do.
available to us in the United States? Do you know?
This early Captain Britain stuff I don't think has been reprinted anywhere now.
Yeah. And I think
So don't ask me
the
how I got it, because I don't want to say.
yeah, the other writer you were probably looking for is Gary Friedrich.
Yes, that's who it was. Gary Friedrich came on. He's the one who wrote for a while. I knew it wasn't Bob Adamski because he does come on briefly after Friedrich leaves. But yeah, Friedrich was the one who was doing all of the two captains. And the strip is really, really good. And then
Yeah,
Friedrich
I'm a fan of
leaves.
his. I mean, 'cause he did a ton of work for DC.
Yeah. One of the it was either Gary Friedrich or Mike Friedrich that was involved with Warlock. I think that was Mike, though. Adam Warlock, the pre-Starlet Adam Warlock,
Yeah.
which I've podcasted about over at Resurrections, an Adam Warlock podcast with Al Sedano is the main guy over there. After Friedrich leaves, the story begins meandering, and whenever you have a weekly short strip, one of the things you have to pay attention to is just exactly how you're going to use your supporting cast. And over the 20 or 30 episodes, they had introduced actually they had introduced several clones of Peter Parker's supporting cast. There was a police inspector who hated Captain Britain against all reason. There was a college student, Jacko Tanner, who's just a knucklehead and a loser. And there was the beautiful girl who kind of likes Brian, but Brian doesn't know what to do with, named Courtney. So that's very much right out of the Peter Parker 1970s book. Then Friedrich brought about his twin sister, Betsy, and his older brother, whose name escapes me. I want to say it's also Jack, but I'm not positive. So Brian has two siblings, a twin sister Betsy, who of course Betsy would go on to gain superpowers. She
Right.
is Captain Britain for a while, and then of course she becomes Psylocke in the United States X-Men books. And so, you have these characters, they show up from time to time. So whenever they're there, it's kind of a special moment of Brian being Brian and not being Captain Britain. But after Friedrich leaves, the writers who follow don't really know how to use them very effectively, and they only Betsy and the older brother only show up briefly again before the strip gets folded into Spider-Man. Bob Budansky writes for a short while. Larry Lieber writes for a short while, and they are both co-scripted by a guy named Jim Lawrence. And Jim Lawrence co-scripts with them for a long time and then eventually takes over the book on his own. He has very few other comics credits that I've found from the big two, but evidently he has a lot of work with your less mainstream comics and some prose stuff. I after the Friedrich run ends, there's very little to recommend the series. And I just finished the run last night with Super Spider-Man and Captain Britain 246, and then 247 they start reprinting because Captain Britain came over and did a Chris Claremont Marvel team-up story for two issues with Arcade, and so they reprint that for a few issues of Super Spider-Man Captain Britain, and then Captain Britain is off the map for a couple of years. Black Knight has a strip in the Hulk comic. The weekly Hulk comic, but it's only like 3 or 4 pages per issue, so it's a really different way of reading comics. But Captain Britain does co-star in that sometimes, even though it's a Black Knight comic. And then Captain Britain doesn't get used again until Alan Davis picks it up with Marvel Superheroes 377, and Alan Davis's stuff then leads into Alan Moore's stuff, and those are the two runs that most people recommend as a prelude to Excalibur.
He did have
Because
some
those.
team ups, right? Marvel team ups.
Yeah, the two
And
team up.
also two Marvel 2-in-1 maybe. I don't know.
I don't know of a 2-in-1 appearance. I do. Oh, he may have appeared in 2-in-1. Yeah. He also appeared in a couple of Captain Americas. But as far as having his own book, the first run of Captain Britain is basically overlooked and thrown out. In favor of, because that stuff is British comics being written by American writers.
Yeah.
And it's
It
it, it
sounds interesting to me. At least, like, I'm not the biggest Claremont fan, but I am a Friedrich fan. So
yeah, and
like
that's a
you have my interest in the Friedrich piece because My only exposure to this character is Marvel Team Up for the most part, and Excalibur. And
Right.
then all the other stuff that came after it, you know.
With Alan Davis
And
now and
I've
more, you
never
have
latched
British
on
people.
to his stuff though. I've never, 'cause he's got that whole different realm and stuff. I never cared for it.
And
But
I haven't gotten very much into all that. Like, it's been hinted at because we have had Merlin and stuff appear. And Captain Britain, like, is involved in
Avalon, you
multiverse
know,
and
the
stuff.
that's what
Yeah,
I'm thinking
Avalon.
for, Avalon.
But that comes about whenever you have British people writing British comics with Davis and Moore, which is a very, very different thing. Like, you read Captain Britain started around the same time that 2001 AD started. And talk about two very different kinds of comics. You have Americans trying to write for England, and then you have England writing underground adventure comics, and those are two very, very different things.
And it's interesting too, because the next time I delved into Marvel UK was when they launched again in the 90s with like Death's Head and Motormouth and
And there was
all
a new
those,
Transformers volume too.
yeah, all those Marvel UK titles that came out. And they were weird, man. Like they were very different.
But yeah, I'm reading Captain Britain as I read X-Men, so that's what I've read so far. And I'll be starting his Black Knight Hulk comic run later today.
But you're,
That's cool.
are you, aren't you ahead of this,
I
the
am,
X-Men,
so
because
I'm
of
doing a lot
Betsy,
of catch
because of
up.
Braddock, like Psylocke and stuff?
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of I'm trying to get all of Captain Britain read before I get to New Mutants Annual 2, where you have Psylocke first introduced. So I'm
Okay.
trying to get so there's a lot of catch up I'm doing right now.
So is this like all first time? Like you hadn't read this before?
I have not read any Marvel 80s is a treasure trove that I am just beginning to get into.
Okay.
To me,
Nice.
80s Marvel seems like a second golden age for Marvel. Like 60s and 80s are like Marvel's two high points. And which is not to slight the 70s because there's a lot of good stuff in the 70s, but I feel like, your 60s Marvel and your 80s Marvel are just amazing. And because that Spider-Man has the Hobgoblin stuff in there, got the Alien Costume Saga in there. The Black Cat and getting proposing to Mary Jane, all that stuff. That's big 80s. In Avengers, you have John Byrne. In Fantastic Four, you have John Byrne. Thor has Walt Simonson.
Yeah,
So,
all the runs that people remember.
yeah.
Bob Layton and Michelinie on Iron Man. So, yeah,
And
you got a lot
so,
of great stuff.
yeah, I'm just getting into it with my X-Men reading is really the first time I've really delved into the 80s.
Cool. So, Chris, do you got any another book?
I'm pretty much all done. I wanted to mention that I picked up after taking a break on my Star Trek watching again.
Yeah.
Where are you?
So I'm digging deeper into season 3 now of the original series. So and I'm not gonna really talk at length about anything, but I did find it really interesting. The most recent episode that I watched was called Plato's Stepchildren. And it wasn't really the greatest episode. It's one of those things where they end up on a planet where there's a society that's developed that connects back to some other like historical Earth society, and in this case, it's a society that is organized around ancient Greek, but
But
they,
in a single room with like five actors.
yeah, you definitely see the budget of season 3 on display there, and these people, they have telekinetic powers, although the definition of telekinesis really is not consistent because they also seem to be able to control people's emotions as well. It turns out that they have these telekinetic powers because of something, some kind of element. I forget what they say it is. It's something that McCoy identifies and is able to inject into Kirk and Spock. Kyrenide is like a kyrenide mineral in the food supply of the planet. And so he puts like a concentrated dose, and like what the thing that's interesting about this episode though is the aliens they beam down, eventually beam down Uhura and what's her name? What's her name?
Not
McCoy's
Chapel, is it?
assistant. Nurse Chapel, yeah, Nurse Chapel. They beam them down and get them all done up in like Greek fashions and stuff. And so then they have this event where it's a put on for amusement and display of the Alien Society. And it's Spock and Kirk, Nurse Chapel and Uhura, and in part of it, they force them to be in couples. And of course, you know, it's kind of interesting with Spock and Chapel because at this point it's well established that Chapel has feelings for Spock, and you know, he's too Vulcan to reciprocate. But the really interesting thing is the background information on Kirk and Uhura and Uhura, because this is 1968, and the only early, like, so I find this out about after watching the episode, that earlier in the year was the first time that a man a female a white female and a black male had for the first time had direct physical contact on American television. So basically the first time there was any kind of physical contact between a man and a woman of different races on American TV, and that was just Petula Clark touching Harry Belafonte's arm. So
But you
because of this
also
script,
had Uhura kiss Kirk, too.
that's what I'm getting to,
Well, that
Mike.
doesn't count, yeah.
Way
You
to
spoiled
spoil the
the ending.
punchline.
Premature completion.
But yeah, that was a big problem when the script came in, that everybody knows that already, but it was really interesting to read about how they were really concerned about Kirk and Uhura kissing, and so they wanted two versions of the scene filmed, one where they kiss and one where they don't. And Shatner and Nichols weren't cool with that, so they purposely ruined every take of the not kissing scenes. So, you know, Shatner just like really poured it on, did like absolute awful acting. He would purposely cross his eyes and like make a really funny face. And so basically they ran out of time, and they ultimately like ruined any chance of them having a take where they didn't kiss. So I thought that was really cool and really interesting, and basically they figured they were going to be canceled anyway, so they just went ahead and just ran it in all locations with the kiss. And you know, so you wouldn't think of it as like a really important episode, but Nichelle Nichols, I guess, looks back on this episode as a really important one because of that. And she said that they didn't really get much negative feedback at all. In fact, they got a lot of positive feedback, and girls wrote her and asked like what it was like to kiss Captain Kirk, and
It's like kissing a vampire with less saliva.
exactly.
It is
Yes, they.
interesting though, if you go to like panels, that's always a. If you go to a Shatner panel or if you go to a Nicole Nichols panel, they always ask that question. It like
Oh,
I've
really?
been to I've been to two of her panels and it came up both times. And it came up in Shatner's.
That's.
Shatner's hilarious. If you ever get a chance to see him, he is like a dynamic speaker. Like off the cuff, he could just talk about anything.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, I as usual, you know, I show my ignorance whenever I talk about these Star Trek episodes. I'm like, dude, you guys, did you realize that Kirk and Uhura kiss in this episode? And everyone that's listening is just nodding, like, yeah, I've known about that since I was 12. But
Well, it is kind of cool for everyone to find out the first time. This being Black History Month, there have been at our school daily announcements, they've pulled out random people to spotlight, a brief description of their life and accomplishments. And so one morning I was just like, "Hey, did y'all know what show do you think was the first interracial kiss on television?" It's weird to watch that scene though, because of the dynamics of the scene and they're being forced against their will. I mean, Kirk really does not like the fact that he's being forced to kiss Uhura, but it's for all of the reasons that are not what culture would expect, So it's a little bit weird to just watch it out of context, but it's really, really cool.
That's
Did y'all
true.
realize that the very first television show that had an ensemble cast led by a black man? But like a non-black ensemble or various races ensemble cast led by a black man was Star Trek: Deep Space Nine.
No, I didn't realize that.
Before that, all of your black leading actors were, all their supporting actors were also black. You never had, or your black would be like the number two to a white guy or something like that. But it's but yeah, Deep Space Nine, Sisko.
That's cool.
Not to be confused with
I
Sisko on The Flash.
I didn't realize that. And I
That's cool.
watch a lot of those old comedies. Like I was watching The Jeffersons just the other day, and as the only white guy is Bentley. He walks in, and he's a very minor character.
And I grew up watching Good Times, and
I
white
just
people in that
watched an
show were
episode.
almost.
There, I didn't see them, and I've seen that lately because like one of those channels like Encore Black or Stars Black shows like Good Times and the Jeffersons like all the time, and I
And
just
my
saw.
impression of that is that usually, whenever white people would show up, they were jerks to one degree or another.
Well, I don't think like Bentley was a jerk. He was just stupid. I mean, he was
No,
just
I've been in Good Times.
well. Oh, Good Times. I don't even remember white people in there.
It was a rare thing, but they're in Harlem, and it would be kind of it would feel kind of weird to have like the one white person walking down the sidewalk towards you. That would be odd in 1970s New York or 80s New York.
Yeah, Bentley was really intelligent because he'd make like crazy references, but he was wacky. And then on Sanford and Son, you had the two cops. You had the black cop and the white cop. And the white cop just never would get anything. Like they'd have to explain to him stuff. Yeah, it's interesting. So my last pick, I'll be quick, is because of Superman versus or Batman versus Superman. I decided to revisit the Loeb Ed McGuinness. This has been a cartoon too, run of Superman Batman. Seems like they took a lot of animated series out of this. They have the Supergirl Dark Side episode animated series, and they have this one. And this is a really good written because Loeb does a good job of like alternating voices in the caption. Like you'll hear what Superman in issue two has been shot with a kryptonite bullet and they're trying to hide from Metallo, and Batman's in bad shape too and they're underground and they're just trying to get out of this situation alive, and they have to go through the sewers to get to a place where Alfred is there with a shotgun. And Clark is shot and delirious, and he's like, "Wow, why is your butler carrying a shotgun around in near the Bat Cave?" But it had some cool references. It had a cool reference to their first post-crisis meeting, which was Man of Steel number 3. where they talked a little bit about Magpie, who was a really, really wacky villain who liked to blow up a lot of stuff just because she liked shiny objects. But it was a really good story because here Lex Luthor's president and he's kind of bossing Captain Atom around continuously. You have a future Superman come back and talk to Superman and actually fight him in the Batcave. And there's just a lot of stuff that goes back and forth on here. And I really enjoyed it. It seems like a long, long time ago, but
It's been a while back now. That was what, 2004?
This is quite a while. Yeah, 2003.
Damn. Yeah,
So
that's a long time ago, dude.
it is a long time ago, but it seems very recent. And I
You're
think it's because.
talking Teen Titans graduation day and that
Yeah.
the revival of Battlestar Galactica, the first miniseries before it went to regular episodes. It's a long time ago.
Yeah, it is a long time ago. And maybe that's fresh in my mind because I saw the cartoon a couple years ago. But it's really cool. There's a lot of cool plot twists. I really have always liked Captain Atom too, and I like his part in here. And I really like the scene where Alfred pulls the kryptonite bullet from Superman. So much good dialogue between the two, and how what I really like about it is the them thinking about in their caption boxes of what one thinks of the other. That there's just, I mean, you can't. I think it could potentially pale tribute to that in Matt the movie that's coming up, but who knows what they'll do with it. The director is always saying he pays close attention to the comics, and he has in the past with other properties. So who knows what Easter eggs we'll get out of this new movie. But that's all I had. Having said that, do you want to give your contact information, John, and let them know more about your podcast? So if they want to check out your Avengers podcast or your other podcasts, they'll be able to find them.
Sure, the Avengers show that I do with my daughter is housed, homed and housed becomes hosed. It lives at the Complete Marvel Reading Order website. So if you just do a search on Google for Complete Marvel Reading Order and click the podcast tab on that website, you'll see episodes there. Same with the feed. If you want to find it on one of your favorite podcatchers, search for Complete Marvel Reading Order, and you'll see our episodes listed there. The Giant Superman podcast that has a couple episodes out and is going to be a monthly, end of every month. We look at several Superman stories from the 60s that were reprinted in the annuals. I'm doing that one, and then the guy I have doing it with me was young and reading them when they came out. So it's a nice combination we have going there. That's the Giant Superman podcast at giantsuperman.libsyn.com. Both those have Facebook pages. If you like the Facebook, I am on Twitter at John Reads Comics, no H, where I tweet about comics that I'm reading and podcasts that I release and that sort of thing. It's a very comic heavy feed. So, just warn you ahead of time if that's not especially your thing. But yeah, so come check it out and drop me a line if you listen to something and like it.
Cool
If you listen to
beans.
something and don't like it, then I guess you can talk to me too. Just be nice.
And you can reach us at geekbrunchpodcast.com, at Mike Myers Brunch, and at MythMakingETC on the Twitters. And on Facebook, it's Geek Brunch Podcast. And what else did I miss? Oh, emails, mike@comicbooknoise.com and mythmakingetc@gmail.com. And on behalf of Retrocast, I want to thank you for taking 3 hours of your time on a Sunday to chat with us. We really
This was
enjoyed it.
fun. This was just Geek Brunch Retrocast. I thought maybe I should bring some waffles or some omelets or something, but I just brought comics and turned out to be okay, so that's good.
That just means that you can eat if you want.
Oh.
and share your
Well, hell,
experience.
I should have brought the waffles anyway.
Yeah, it was really cool having you on, John, getting to talk to you, and thought you brought some really cool stuff to talk about, speaking of bringing comics, and glad we had the opportunity to have you on. Glad you wanted to join us.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. This is great.
Thanks, and we'll see you around. And hopefully, you could come on again at some point when you get further into all these other books you're talking about.
All the reading projects, because once you
We'll
read
know
one
you
comic, you
have
like
some
all the
kind
books.
of project going on.
I have a lot of similarities to you, except I have more of an ADD where I'll like. I'll read a bunch of something and then I need to jump into another publisher or something just to refresh my mind. And I just get distracted like that. And then I go back and revisit it. So I don't like stick the course like you do. I'll eventually get back to it, but it takes me a while.
Yeah, there is that whole phenomenon of while you're focusing on one reading project and all the other things that catch your interest and are talking to your brain while you're doing it. So, yeah, I understand
I'm a comic reader that goes, "Oh, squirrel," I get
that.
distracted. All right. Well, thanks again, and you guys have a good Sunday afternoon.
All right, thanks.
Take
You too,
care.
my friend. All
Bye.
right, bye, guys.